Okay, you can look now. You okay, Marie? You still want to go home? Marie?
I don't hear anything.
Maybe it's my boyfriend. Where have you been? This is great. Somebody's following me.
Will you watch the movie?
But when I was down...
Shh, come on.
No.
What are you doing here? Look, I think you should leave.
No, Frank, he's back.
You wouldn't give me an F now, would you, Professor?
Amy's been a little edgy lately. She's getting married in 2 years.
Oh.
And she thinks some maniac's following her around.
No.
Hey, what is it? What's the matter?
He's after me, Marvin. He's trying to kill me. He killed Nancy.
Hello, this is Caitlin O'Haney, the final girl from He Knows You're Alone. And you're listening to Hysteria Continues.
Okay, well, you are listening to Hysteria Continues, and this is Armand Mastroianni, the director of He Knows You're Alone, and you'll hear all about it very soon.
And indeed you will. This is the Hysteria Continues, episode number 67, and we are covering, as you heard from that, He Knows You're Alone this episode. I'm very excited. We've got two fantastic interviews, one with Armand, the director of the film, and also Caitlin O'Haney, who is the final girl from the film. They've got some fun interviews coming up, and also lots and lots of info and back, you know, stories and everything from that. But before we get onto that, I have to ask, Eric, are you alone?
I am.
Are you?
I'm alone.
Okay, and are you naked?
Of course.
Yes.
Well, it's another scorcher in Dublin. What do you expect? I have to close all the flipping windows and turn the fan off.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. Joseph.
But Justin.
Oh, yes.
Do you know that he knows you're a goth?
Well, I'm not a goth, am I, Eric?
You are. You know. You're sitting there in your black lipstick and your veil. I can see you on the webcam.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do I look a bit like Patrick Wilson at the end of Insidious?
Yes.
I think I probably look a bit better than that, actually, in a black veil. But we won't dwell on that. Joseph.
You look actually when speaking of Insidious Part 2, there is a character in it that reminded me of you, but I probably shouldn't say. It's really a spoiler.
Okay, right. Well,
let's just say there's a boy who likes to wear women's clothes.
You know that's not true, Eric.
And anyway, I've seen the party pictures.
Anyway, I have. We've got a quiz coming up, so if you don't want me to give you a hard one, or several hard ones, then you need to keep your mouth shut, Eric, don't you?
Yes.
Yes. Right, thank you. Joseph, are you alone?
Naturally.
Okay. And are you...
You know the alone again, naturally?
I don't know that. No, it's not...
By Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Yeah, Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Okay.
Oh.
Ah, see, the culture on this show continues.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And no, Nathan. It's Gilbert O'Sullivan, not Gilbert and Sullivan.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. That's the Irish in Eric.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Eric. Nathan, are you alone?
No. Wes is here. Axel's here. Whitey and Stripes are here. And Oscar is here.
Okay. So.
Who's Oscar?
My fish.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, there's the hell he knows you're alone link, if ever there was one.
Indeed. Yes. Yes.
But so, yeah, I'm just saying, my head could not fit in his tiny little beta tank. So if any killers out there listening, it's not worth it. So just stay home.
Okay. Right. Well, we are prepping for the He Knows You're Alone coming up a little bit later. And I say, we have got a quiz. So hold on to your hats for some Inga-style meltdowns. What?
I'm confident I'm going to win this one.
Okay. Okay, well, we shall see. We shall see. But before we get on to that, in time-honoured tradition, let's talk about what we've been watching recently. And Eric, I'll start with you first, because I think we've both seen Insidious 2.
We have, yes.
What did you think of it?
I did enjoy it. I thought that for the first hour it was very much treading water. I didn't think the plot was going anywhere, and it was just a series of episodic scare sequences stitched together. I liked the last half hour better, and I liked the... How would you describe it? So, actually, Meep, who was our guest in the last episode, described it as being like the Back to the Future Part 2 of supernatural horror, and I get what he means, because there are scenes in the last half of the film where you revisit scenes from the first film, but seen from a different perspective, if you know what I mean, and it has, a time and dimension jump element to it. But it is, and another comparison that's been made a lot is with Poltergeist 2, which it's a comparison I made with the first Insidious, but it's far more apparent in the sequel. But I mean, I did enjoy it. Not as I thought it was better than The Conjuring, but not as good as the first Insidious.
Okay, because I didn't think it was as good as The Conjuring. I think probably enjoyed The Conjuring a bit more. But I thought it's perfectly serviceable, and there were bits in it were really good. But it wasn't particularly cohesive, was it?
No. And I missed the red-faced demon from the first one, which I thought was a really spooky image.
It also kind of goes off in slightly different territory, doesn't it, without giving anything away. But they James Wan said it's kind of almost like The Shining, isn't it? Because it comes a kind of, the threat
yes.
becomes more physical, which I thought was kind of, it was interesting. It was nice to see Lin Shaye back.
She gets top billing, but she isn't in it that much.
No. Mm. I mean, it sets itself up for a sequel, doesn't it? And I know Joseph and Nathan, you haven't seen it, have you?
No, not yet.
No. But I think it did pretty well at the box office, didn't it? I mean, they've already announced part 3.
It's done really well. And I'm 40, glad it has. Yeah.
41 million opening, I believe it was.
Mm. I mean, the ending sets it up for a sequel, doesn't it? But with a sequel without most of the main characters, I imagine, because I think Patrick Wilson has said he's not doing any more, but he's probably doing the Conjuring 2, isn't he? He's probably going to get a bit bored of it. And James Wan rather controversially said he's done with horror,
which is a shame because he's one of the best around at the moment.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can see why he would want to move on to do stuff. Yeah. It's just there was a big discussion on the boards, wasn't there, saying that he perhaps didn't do it quite as graciously as he could have done. Basically, he just sort of said, "I'm done with horror." That caused a little debate, didn't it, on the boards? But I think it's a shame because I think he's very, very good at creating mood and scare scenes. I think it's, you know, I mean, what I would like an Insidious 2 is like a fairground ride, isn't it? Mark Kermode, who's a critic in Britain, was very, very rude about it, and he's really hated it. And he said it was just like a, you know, quite loud kind of way of filmmaking. But I don't really see that as a problem, because it's a popcorn horror movie which is setting out to scare you and make you jump. I mean, that's, you know, and they didn't take it too seriously, and so that it's like a fairground ride, and I don't have a problem with that. It's kind of safe horror, but I thought it's pretty effective, and I'll pick up the Blu-ray when it comes out. I think it's a good companion piece to the first one.
Have either of you seen the pornographic version yet?
What's it called?
Inside Us.
Is it?
No, I just made that up.
Well, that'll be made very soon, won't it?
Yeah,
I imagine. Yes. With a red face.
Probably starring that woman we were talking about recently. I can't remember what she was in, but she was in all those pornos.
Terry Wiggle.
That's it.
Yes.
That's it. Yeah.
But what else have you been watching?
Okay, well, I caught up on Crystal Lake Memories, which is the big 7-hour documentary that Dan Farrens has brought out, and we were talking to him in the last show. It's really, really well made. I mean, it's, of course, by the same team that did Never Sleep Again, which I absolutely adored, that documentary. With this one, however, the problem I had with it, and it's nothing to do with the filmmakers or the content. It's really, really good. But I've read Crystal Lake Memories, the book, twice now. I read it when it came out in hardback in 2005. And then I bought the ebook edition, which was expanded and had more interviews and more pictures and had video clips as well in it. I read that earlier this year, so the information was still kind of fresh in my head. So when I was watching the documentary, it was just the same information being regurgitated. Now, there is some new nuggets in there, you know, to learn, and it's nice to see the participants as they look now. But I just didn't get as much, you know, information, or I wasn't as engrossed in it as I was with Never Sleep Again. But again, it's not a fault of the filmmakers. There's only, you know, there's a finite amount of information you can get out of the Friday the 13th series. And, you know, I think it's all out there now at this stage. For me, what was probably better was the commentary track on it, which is the filmmakers talking for nonstop for 7 hours, which is it's actually really, really good. It's like a really long Friday the 13th podcast. They're really quite honest about what their thoughts are in each episode in the series, and it's just really interesting to hear, and also the reasons behind why some people didn't want to participate and how difficult it was to put the documentary together, blah, blah, blah. They also mentioned that although they did the special features for the deluxe editions of the final chapter up until Jason Takes Manhattan, they weren't allowed to use any of that footage in Crystal Lake Memories, which is why you have somebody like Tiffany Helm, who plays Violet in part five. She's in the documentary. She's in the special features of part five, but she doesn't appear in Crystal Lake Memories. But because of scheduling conflicts, they couldn't get to re-interview her. But they have reused some footage from his name was Jason, which was a documentary they made in 2008 or 2009. So, you know, there are some people, there are, you know, omissions in it. And of course, I mean, you have quite a big cast in every, you know, film in the series. So it's going to be impossible to get everyone. But I think it's a great documentary, and I'm sure coming back to it maybe in a couple of years' time, when the information is not still lingering in my head, it'll probably be more engrossing documentary for me. But I do urge everyone to seek it out. It's really, really good. You've had a chance to watch some of it, Justin, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got up to part three. I mean, it's really nicely put together. They've you know, it looks like it's got a budget behind it. That makes
it
sense.
It does, and they've actually got loads of film clips in it as well, not just from Friday the 13th, but if somebody mentions Halloween or if somebody mentions some other film, they usually have a short clip from it, which is, you know, probably wasn't cheap to get the right licensing rights to, but they have it in there.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because it's it must have cost a small fortune to do that, because I know when I was working, I did the Slice and Dice Forever, and that was done on a real shoestring, but it was, you know, with a lot of love. But the I think you can use stuff from trailers in because they're done for promotional purposes, but to actually license footage is really, really costly, especially from a big studio. So but I really liked the kind of opening scene. It's got Corey Feldman, hasn't it, all sat around the fire, and he's the campfire with loads of teenagers, well, not loads, but a group of kind of very Friday the 13th looking early 20-somethings all sat around the campfire, and he's telling them the story of Jason. So there's a kind of attention to detail.
The opening credits are done in the style of a Friday the 13th film, with the white graphics on a black background moving from different parts of the screen. And then every chapter, I suppose you'd call it, in the documentary is done in the style of the opening credits of that film. So, for instance, for part three, the title for that chapter comes flying out the screen like they do in the film. And then for part four, you have the mask, and the title of the chapter makes the mask explode, if you know what I mean. So yeah, it's really well done. Really well done.
Yeah. You, Joseph and Nathan, you've not seen it yet, have you?
No, no, not yet. I didn't
actually
watch it, though.
Yeah, I actually thought I would be bored by the time it got to Jason Goes to Hell, Jason versus Freddy, and that Freddy versus Jason even. But Monica Keena, who is the final girl in Freddy versus Jason, is incredibly funny in her section. I really warmed to her. I thought she was really, really funny. When you get to Freddy versus Jason, you'll know what I mean, Justin. So
okay, yeah, no, well, I'm sure I look forward to that. And, anything else?
Yes, I'll just mention one other, and this is God knows why I rented this on Blu-ray, but I did. It was Scary Movie 5, why? Because I've hated the other four. It spoofs mainly the Paranormal Activity series. That's in the pre-credit sequence. The bulk of the film is spoofing Mama, and then it has elements of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, God knows why, Black Swan, Inception, and Evil Dead. And one of the things that really stands out from the very start is that the film has a narrator who, for no particular reason, sounds like Morgan Freeman. But whenever there's a presence of a narrator in the film, it always is an indication to me that there was something wrong with the plot, and to paper over its cracks they had to put a narration in. But I mean, I don't know what it was needed for. This film has absolutely no plot, and it has no laughs except one. The only time I laughed was there's a scene where the lead character is trying to look up information about the Book of the Dead, which she finds in a cabin on the internet, and it just keeps directing her to pornographic sites, which I thought was kind of funny. But God, the film is awful, and it's so short. It runs for about 70 minutes, and then there's 15 minutes of end credits. But no, stay away from it. It's a health hazard. It's horrible.
So have you learnt your lesson now, Eric?
I have, yeah.
So you won't be watching Scary Movie 6?
No.
No.
I won't. I've learnt my lesson.
We'll hold you to that.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well,
I thought one of us should have to watch it.
Yes, no, fair enough. You're taking one for the team.
Yeah.
Yeah, which probably wouldn't be the first time, would it, Eric?
Hey.
So, Nathan, how about you? What have you been watching?
I haven't watched a whole lot of horror lately, to be honest. I did watch that new crime drama suspense movie called Prisoners.
Oh, yeah.
Wes and I went to the theater and watched it, which it's not technically horror, but, you know, it's, I guess, got a few elements of horror in it, enough where I could mention it. And I actually really liked it. You know, it's a little too long for me. I don't think a movie that's like a crime drama like that needs to be over 2 hours long. Mm. And this movie's like 2.5 hours long. And it's just, it's too long for the subject matter. I kept watching it thinking of all the better editing that could have been done. Like, there's just so many scenes that should have ended up on the cutting room floor. Mm. And, you know, it would have made the movie a lot better paced, I think. But, I mean, it's not a bad movie, though. You know, I mean, the whole central idea behind it, I was interested until the very end to find out what happened to the kids.
I mean, so. It's not opened here, I don't think.
It has. It opened yet on Friday.
Oh, did it? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just out of touch. But so is it a recommend from you, Nathan?
A recommend with some slight hesitation.
Hmm.
Mainly okay. Because I think that a lot of people might get a little bored, especially because of how long it is.
Right. Okay. Oh, Eric.
Justin, do you ever find that something is too long for you?
Rarely.
Oh, right.
So, anything else, Nathan, or have you?
That's it.
That's it. Okay, well, thank you. How about you, Joseph?
Well, the only horror slasher thing related I've watched is Curse of Chucky.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah. Any good? Which, I really enjoyed it with a few reservations. I'd say it's the best in the series next to the first one, or the first two, at least.
Okay.
The first hour is a lot of mood and setup, and it's just terrific. I mean, Chucky's mainly in the shadows, and he doesn't open his mouth or anything, or, you know, spew any one-liners. And it's set in a big gothic mansion, and there's a huge rainstorm. So, you know, the first hour I was really with this film, and, you know, I'm not going to go into spoiler territory, but there's a great dinner scene. That's all I'll say. It's very suspenseful and kind of, you know, wickedly comical at the same time. But my problem is once Chucky actually starts talking, it just kind of descends back into the same old thing of, you know, tired one-liners. And it's not as, you know, prevalent as, say, in Bride or Seed of Chucky. But, you know, some of them are kind of cringe-inducing. But, you know, when they keep Chucky in the shadows and, you know, the characters don't know what's going on, it really does work really well. And it's really well made. And I also another problem I do have with it is that it has too many like false endings. They just didn't really know when to call it quits, and they just kept piling on different endings to kind of tie every movie in the series together. And, you know, by the time they started doing that, I was just, you know, I was like, all right, you should have ended, you know, about 20 minutes ago. You said all you needed to say, just stop. But they just kept going. So, yeah, I'd say go see it. It really is fairly good, at least for the first hour. You know, a lot of people might like the kind of jokey endings, rather. But I wasn't a big fan of it. But overall, yeah, a marginal recommendation.
Okay. I've heard some good things about it. Isn't what I'm really confused about? Isn't there another Child's Play movie coming out as well? Is this?
Oh, I have no idea.
There's rumors of a remake, isn't there?
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Well, this was supposed to be a remake, I believe, but then they just. You'd think for the first like hour it really is a remake because there's really no ties to any of the films until the, you know, the last like 20 minutes and they try to, you know, tie everything together. Mm. So I'd say the first hour at least is a remake, but you know, the last 20 minutes just kind of decides to go back and try to, you know, connect the dots, as it were.
Okay. Well, no, it sounds I'll definitely check it out, I'm sure.
I've seen it as well.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yeah. I did really enjoy it as well. It doesn't reinvent the wheel or anything. It's not. There's nothing startlingly new about it. It's all set in a gothic house, big gothic mansion, so you'd probably really like it, Justin. Yeah. It actually has one of the actresses from Insidious 2 in it, Danielle Bisuti. She plays the spooky woman in Insidious 2, and she's here as a bitchy sister in Curse of Chucky. I would give it a strong recommendation as well. It features one of those cliched kids who talks to Chucky and goes around as if it's normal. I mean, if I was 6 or 7 and a doll started talking to me, I would be freaked out. Yet this is one of these Hollywood horror movie kids who speaks to ghosts and that and doesn't seem to think it's any way weird.
Right. Okay.
You know the kind of kids I mean in these films? They sit and have tea parties with ghosts and...
The imaginary friend.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I'd be spooked. Mm. I mean, I don't know what the world's coming to.
Well, no, fair enough. But Nathan, you've not seen it.
No, I really want to though. But I mean, it's not available to rent till October the 8th. So, and right now the only way to watch it is to buy it. And you know, I'm not really in a position to be buying movies just yet.
Mm. Okay, no, fair enough. But look, it didn't get a cinema release, did it? So.
But it looks very cinematic. It would easily be at home in the cinema, I think.
I think it was meant to, wasn't it? I think the intention was for it to come out of the cinema, and it just obviously, for whatever reason, they decided not to do that, go down that route. So I don't know why. But okay, well, I just rattled through a couple I saw. I was off earlier this week because I hurt my foot at the weekend. So
drinking.
No, well, I was drinking, but that wasn't the reason I fell over.
You were drinking so much, and then you tripped over and fell down a hill.
Well, no, I was going round. What actually happened, Eric, was I was we were in the middle of the deepest, darkest Wales, and it was really dark, and it was about midnight. There were lots of people around the table outside, and the candles blew out. And as I was walking, trying to get back to my chair, I slipped on some mud and grabbed hold of some barbed wire, the fence, which I let go of, and then I just slipped and twisted my ankle. So there you go. So thank you for the sympathy. But anyway, I had a day off booked on Monday, so I just thought, well, I'll just treat myself to watch some right old shite on TV. And so on demand, I watched Detention of the Dead, which is a kind of a horror comedy set in a high school where the kind of the zombie apocalypse breaks out. And it's actually quite good. It's not groundbreaking. It's not fantastic, but I quite enjoyed it. It's got a fairly decent budget as well, and lots of, so it's not really cheaply done, and it's a little bit like the Breakfast Club. Which one's the one? No, is it Breakfast Club? It's the one set in the detention.
They're all
Yeah. So it's like they're basically the Detention of the Dead. So it's a bit like Breakfast Club. You've got all of the kind of, you know, you've got the goth girl and you've got the jock and the cheerleader and the nerd and the stoner. So it's very much a kind of like a stereotypical, but they're all sort of brought together to try and sort of fight off the hordes of the undead. So it's very much in the style of an 80s horror comedy as well. So it doesn't take itself too seriously, but there are some quite gory. Has anyone seen that?
No.
Okay. But anyway,
I'm zombied out.
Yeah. No. I just needed something brain dead, literally, for just to watch on Monday. But the other film I saw, which I'm sure would be more up Joseph Street, was The Bay, which the found footage film. Which has anyone seen that?
The Barry Levinson found footage film, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you seen it?
I started watching it and I stopped for some reason. I don't remember why, but go on.
Okay. Well, no, I you know, again, it was kind of a, it's quite a high budgeted found footage film, and it's kind of set in a small town, like on an estuary or something, and the basically fish, or there's basically some nature mutating, and a lot of the townspeople come down with this rash, which basically turns out to be parasites, which start eating them from the inside out. So half the town starts dying horrible ways, and it's kind of found footage from around the town of lots of different scenarios, like from police cars and various things like that. And I really enjoyed it. It's not amazing, but it's quite a good fun and very gory as well. And it's not something you would expect someone like Barry Levinson to make, to be honest. But that would be a recommend, I think, for me, if you're looking for something kind of... it's also kind of got that kind of social commentary about factory farming and you know, kind of abusing nature and nature coming back to bite you on the ass kind of thing. So it's got a little bit more going to it than just like a B-movie. But yeah, that'd be worth a watch if you haven't watched it already. So...
Justin, you just sounded very American there.
Did I?
You said ass, not you said ass, not yeah. Arse or arse.
I know.
Arse.
So you're rubbing off on me again, Joseph.
Yeah, yeah, I like rubbing off on Justin.
Right. Well, I think we should get on to... Are you... Basically, hold on to your hats. It's going to be a bumpy ride. We have plenty of Inga moments possibly in store, but possibly not all from Eric. We'll see what happens, because, well, I seem to remember last time Nathan got quite heated.
Yep, worked. That's because Joseph's quizzes are always rigged, and I'm sure yours are now as well.
I got heated because Joseph gives me a question from a movie he knows I don't like. So, of course, I'm not going to get that question right.
Okay. You picked the question.
Exactly.
I don't agree with that. I think you had them lined up pre-chosen.
I agree. I think Justin will do the same.
Well, here's a little bit of musical intro. So, we are going to start. We've got 10 rounds of questions as we'll rattle through them. But the first one is going to be... it's basically... What I've done is taken sound clips from trailers, so like taglines from trailers of 80s slasher movies. Some are harder than others. But what we'll do, I've got them in random order. So, Eric, do you want to do door number one, door number two, or door number three?
Well, does it matter?
Yes, it does, because they're in order. I'm not cheating.
Yeah, right. One, then, please.
One, okay. So, can you tell me what movie this bit of a trailer comes from?
It's going to be the one party to end them all.
Killer Party?
No.
Oh, I knew you had it rigged. I knew you did.
Here we go. Nathan, any idea?
Let's see.
Do you want to play it again?
Yes, please.
It's going to be the one party to end them all.
I don't know. House on Sorority Row.
No. Joseph, any ideas?
Hell Night.
No, it's actually Terror Train.
Oh.
So it's, that's possibly one of the harder ones. But the other two, there's a harder one and an easier one. So, Joseph, do you want to choose a door number two or door number three?
Three.
Okay. Which film does this come from?
Dr. K. Foster, in charge of the excavation, is not spared. She, too, is haunted.
Okay, Kate Foster in charge of the expedition. She is haunted. Kate Foster. I don't know. Is it... What's an expedition movie? This is slasher films, right?
Yes, they're all slasher films, and they are all from the 80s.
Expedition.
Listen to it again, because I think you...
Dr. K. Foster, in charge of the excavation, is not spared. She, too, is haunted.
She, too, is haunted?
Mm.
See, I can't tell if they're saying Cabe Foster or K. Foster.
It's K. Foster.
K. Foster, in charge of the expedition. A girl... Is it?
I'm going to have to hurry you up.
Is it that movie? Oh, what's it called? It's the one set.
Blood Frenzy? I need an answer.
Hello.
Hello. Did you say something?
Is it Blood? Is it Blood Frenzy?
No, it's not. But good, okay. Good guess. How about you, Eric?
That's my answer. Is this? Ooh, I don't know. The Prey.
No. Nathan, how about you?
Scalps.
No, but you're along the right lines because it was actually Excavation. She was saying, not the Expedition. That's why I replayed it for you. But it's actually Ghost Dance.
I've only seen that.
I haven't seen it.
Ah, yeah. Okay. Well, anyway,
I just
now
figure that out.
Yes. Well, the scores and the doors are 0-0-0. But Nathan, here's your chance to redeem yourself.
So when it came time to say goodbye, they decided to make real sure that no one would ever forget the girls.
Nathan.
Oh, House of Sorority Row.
It was indeed.
That's so easy. I knew you'd do this to me, Justin.
Eric, I've got a little bit of music for you.
Oh, I'm playing the world's smallest violin here.
So, sorry, I didn't catch that.
Nothing.
Okay. Right. Well, back to you, Eric. So, A, B, or C?
C.
C. Okay. Well, this is on location, this question. So, Woodsboro is the setting for Scream.
I thought that was going to be the question.
No.
I did too.
But it's a yes or no answer, Eric. So,
is
there really a Woodsboro, or is it just a fictional place?
Like anywhere in America, or specifically in California, wherever.
Well, is Woodsboro a fictional place, or is it a real place?
Fictional.
That is right.
Yay!
So, see Eric?
Yeah.
You can play nicely. So I'm going to give you a point.
All is good again. Now you can play some happy music.
Well, we shall see. Joseph, A or B?
A.
A, okay. If you were visiting Snape Island, which slasher movie would you be in?
Oh, that's Tower of Evil?
Yeah, correct. Well done.
Yay.
The horror of Snape Island.
And for Nathan, say for what fictional town did Pasadena stand in a 70s slasher?
A 70s slasher, eh? I'm going to say Halloween.
You will be correct. So at the end of that round, Nathan is in the lead on two, and Eric and Joseph are tying on one. So that's not too bad, is it?
That was a total guess on my part. I was hoping my question was going to be, is Haddonfield a real town?
No. Sorry. No. But
That's okay.
Right. Well, back to some sound clips. So, Eric, do you want Dawn?
I'm getting to choose all the time first, which is probably unfair, is it?
I don't know. Well, it's all random, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with it.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
I mean, I can mix it up, but it just gets a bit confusing.
Okay, big number two, then, please.
Number two. Okay. Which film does this come from?
There is no escape.
Did he say there is no whiskey?
No. There's always whiskey, Eric. No,
what did he say?
Again.
Sorry.
There is no escape.
Oh, there.
There is no escape.
No escape, yeah, sorry. Oh, there isn't. It's a slasher movie, I assume.
It is. All these sound clips are from 80s slasher movies.
There is no escape. Humongous?
No, but good guess. Nathan, do you want to have a crack
at that? The Initiation?
No. Joseph?
God, that could be any movie. The music sounds familiar, so I'm trying to piece that together. I'm just going to take a wild stab in the dark here. There is no escape. Dun, 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 dun. God, I don't... Chopping Mall?
No, it's actually Mad Man.
Oh.
So.
Would never have guessed.
But if you listen to the music, you listen to it again, it's kind of...
no escape.
And that elephant noise is a bit of a giveaway. So
it threw me off with there is no escape, because I was trying to think of places where a group of people are actually trapped and can't get out.
Mm. No. Well, that's still all good guesses, but you're all wrong. But Joseph, do you want door number one or door number three?
Number one, please.
Number one, okay.
There is no peace. You may end up dead.
There's no peas and there's no whiskey. My God, what am I going to have for tea?
You may end up dead, John. Is it Blood Rage?
No, but a good guess. Nathan, any ideas?
Movie House Massacre.
No, Eric.
Oh, no peace.
Do you want me to play it for you again?
Oh, go on.
There is no peace.
John.
You may end up dead.
That's kind of cracks me up.
I have no idea what it is, so I'm going to have a guess at Girls' School Screamers.
No, another good guess. It's actually, I think Nathan's going to kick himself. It's actually Terror at Ten Killer.
No way! Oh,
yes.
I didn't even know there was a trailer for that.
I didn't know either.
Unfortunately, there is. But which I think we're probably going to be treated to at some point coming up. Oh, yeah. But Nathan, here's your choice.
If you go, don't go all the way.
Oh God, anybody got any tranks?
The Slumber Party Massacre Part 2.
Indeed it is. Well done. So, excellent. Well, at the end of that round, Nathan's still in the lead, so we probably won't be having any Inga Starr meltdowns from Nathan anytime soon.
Yeah, but they could make a comeback, and then I would.
Well, it's probably unlikely. Back to the questions. So, Eric, do you want A, B, or C?
Well, big number two was good to me last time, so I'll go again, please.
Okay, right. Which three slasher flicks featured a character with the surname Loomis?
Psycho.
Yep.
Halloween.
Yep.
Halloween 2. No. Okay, Loomis. You don't accept Halloween the remake as a separate entity, no?
No, it's a different franchise.
Psycho. Halloween. Oh, I don't know what the third one is. Is it? Oh, it's probably some. It's probably some. Oh. Scream.
Yes. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Eric.
Does he get 1 point for that or three?
I think I should get three.
No, you get 1 point.
No, I think he'll find us three.
It's my rules, Eric.
I like how he phrased that, though. I think you'll find that it's three.
Joseph, do you want A or C?
Let's go with C, please.
Okay. The 1979 slasher The Demon, starring Jennifer Holmes and Cameron Mitchell, was not made in the United States. Can you name the country it was filmed in? And for a bonus point...
South Africa.
Yes. And for a bonus point, name the disco in the film.
Is it Demon Boogie?
No, good guess. Can I, anyone else know that?
Oh, do it to me once more.
Sorry?
Do it to me once more.
Is that your answer? Or?
That's my answer. I'm not asking you guys. I'm giving it as an answer.
It's something like Bum or something, isn't it? Or?
It is, along that line. But is that your final answer?
Yeah, I can't think of what it is.
It's Boobs Disco.
Oh, that's this.
So, back onto another last round of sound clips. So, Eric, A, B, or C?
Do I get a question on that round?
Oh, he didn't. Did I get
one? Oh, no, sorry. I do apologise, Nathan. You're so far in the lead.
Okay.
He's not so far in the lead. I'm only one behind him.
Nathan, in 1982's Just Before Dawn, what song was the group listening to as they made their way up the mountain in their RV?
Heart of Glass by Blondie.
Indeed, so yes, well done.
I think you'll find Just Before Dawn is 1981, Justin.
Oh, you are right, yes, sorry. I copied this question how from somewhere else.
Yeah.
How can you trust my...
How can you trust the authenticity of your questions?
I know, that's awful, isn't it? So, anyway, we'll gloss over that. And Eric, let's see if you can get this sound clip. Oh, actually, do you want to choose?
Two again, please.
Two again, okay.
A slash course in absolute terror.
Oh, I recognise that. Is it Cutting Class?
No.
Oh.
Nathan?
It's Sorority House Massacre.
It is. Well done.
Oh.
So... Joseph, do you want door number one or door number two? Three, sorry.
Let's go with number one.
One, okay.
When darkness descends on the city, something happens.
When darkness descends upon the city, something happens. No, because I don't think that has a trailer. Is that a trailer? Yeah, it's a trailer.
It is a trailer, yeah.
No, this definitely doesn't have a trailer. So, city, darkness depends on the city. See, I'm taking these literally, so I'm probably just whitewashing myself here, but,
I'll give you a clue. It's a film we have covered on the podcast.
Well, one out of 60.
Yeah, exactly. That's quite, there's not really much of a clue, is it?
Can you play it one more time, please?
Yes, and listen to the music, because I think that's a giveaway.
When darkness descends on the city, something happens.
God,
I'm going to need an answer.
No. I'm just going to take a guess here. Is it Night School?
It is Night School.
It is Night School.
Oh, man. I can't believe it.
It's my favorite trailer.
Yes. Oh, my God. I cannot believe I got that out of all those. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and the amount of time it took you to get it as well. It didn't at all give you enough time
very
to Google it.
Yes, it does. But, yes, well, we shall. Let's see what Nathan makes of.
It's the only one I could think of that had a city setting, so.
That's what I was thinking as well, but I didn't need to Google it.
Okay, Nathan, here's your final one.
Something not alive like its father. Something better dead. Something that has the form of a human, but not the face.
This better be good.
Oh, God. It's going to be a movie I don't know that well, I bet. Not human like its father. I guess its father was a human. And it's a slasher movie, so I don't know. I have no idea. The Prey?
Not The Prey, no. Eric? Do you want me to play it again?
Yeah, please.
Something not alive like its father. Something better dead. Something that has the form of a human, but not the face.
This better be good.
Is it The Unseen?
No. No. Oh. Joseph, any ideas?
Trying to think of something that has a father.
I'm trying to think of the best words to keywords to Google, is what you mean.
No, blah, 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 blah. I'm just going to take a wild stab here. Is this an 80s slasher?
It is. And it's another one we've...
Yeah, why do you keep giving him clues? I don't get any clues.
Oh.
Well, you have to ask for them.
You didn't ask for them. He told you, he's telling them straight out. Shut up.
So, something Joseph.
Something love like its father.
Why don't you tell him what the title rhymes with?
Sorry, did you say something, Joseph? Well,
Hell Knight?
Over Eric's whinging. Hell Knight. No, not Hell Knight. No, it was actually The Fun House.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because it's something alive in the funhouse, was there?
Yeah.
So, but at the end of that, Nathan's still in quite a commanding lead with 5. Joseph bringing up the rear with 3. And Eric off in the distance with 2.
What? So, I'm the same as Joseph. I have 3 as well.
No, you don't.
I do.
Which ones do you get right?
The other ones.
Well, we'll listen back. If there's, well, let's see if you can get this one right. Okay.
How many more rounds is there?
A few more. Why?
Enough to win.
Yeah, enough for you to win.
Yay.
Okay. So, do you want A, B, or C?
I'll go for C this time.
C. Okay. What quote does this come from? I hate a guy with a car and no sense of humour.
Halloween.
Yes. Well done.
Thank you. Am I winning?
What?
What do you mean, what?
Sorry, I just wanted to be like Eric for a minute.
Okay, fine. Was... So, well done, Eric. And Joseph, do you want A or B?
We'll go with B this time.
Okay. You're nothing. You're shit. And this is that's a quote. I'm not saying that to you. But which won't be victim says this to a famous slasher?
You're giving him.
You're nothing. You're nothing. You're shit.
Yeah.
Now, am I guessing? What am I guessing here? You said character and said it.
Yeah, the character and the film.
Oh, you're nothing. You're shit. Oh, Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well done.
Okay.
And
I'll take A.
Okay. To whom does this quote belong? He's a bad man. He's a really bad man. Which film does that appear in?
He's a bad man. He's a really bad man.
Yeah.
I don't know. I actually knew the other two, and then mine I don't know. It's probably because I don't get to pick my Doors.
Mm.
You like how I threw that back on you, Justin?
Play the violin.
Sorry?
Should play the violin.
So, do you want to take a wild stab?
I don't know. A Friday the 13th movie.
No, because good choice. What about you, Eric? Any idea? He's a bad man. He's a really bad man.
Is it your sister talking about you? No, it's, I don't know, Shocker.
No. Joseph, any ideas?
He's a bad man. He's a really bad man. Is it the Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Which one?
Oh, it's not. It's part 2.
I'm going to give you half a point because it's actually no. Well, it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it's the remake from 2003.
Oh God, I've only seen that one like one time.
Okay, but I think I think you got the right franchise. So I'll give you half a point. Sorry, Eric.
Mm.
Okay.
Why don't I just abandon the quiz and I'll sit here and sing Thompson Twins songs to myself while you play your stupid quiz? Okay.
Okay. All right. So we'll gloss over Eric. Nathan, Eric, do you want A, B, or C? You could still win.
A. Yeah, whatever. Likely.
Okay. In which state is Eyes of a Stranger set?
Oh. Washington?
No.
No.
Joseph, any ideas?
Boy, is Seattle?
No.
No, state. Seattle's in Washington, so never mind.
That's a whole... Yeah. The answer's probably going to be America. And I know in Justin and his geography.
Yeah, no.
The answer's going to be America.
Yeah.
Now, which state? So, Joseph,
Ontario instant all over again.
Oh, we won't go there, Eric. Joseph, any ideas? Or shall I pass it over to Nathan?
It's an actual state.
It's a state, yes.
Seattle City.
So he gets 2 answers.
Well, no,
I only got 1 chance to answer.
I'm not being bullied, Eric.
Why am I being bullied? Joseph said Seattle, and now you're saying, oh, give me another answer.
Let's pass it over to Nathan then.
Oh, okay. Florida.
Thanks, Eric.
Florida. No.
Oh, welcome, Joseph.
No, actually,
you're
no,
beating me.
No, actually, no, you are right. It was in Florida.
Emma?
Yes, in Miami is where it shot. That's in Florida,
sweet.
Isn't it? Yes, so well done.
I was going to say Wisconsin, so never mind.
Okay, right. Well,
It's Joseph next.
Joseph, yes.
Don't forget to give him two chances to answer. Maybe even three if you want.
Oh, we might just do that. B or C?
A, B, or C?
Or B or C, because A's already gone.
B or C. Okay. C, please.
C. In which movie would you find Chalmers the Embalmers?
Say that again?
In which slasher movie would you find Chalmers the Embalmers?
Charmers or Chalmers?
Chalmers. Chalmers.
Chalmers the Embalmers. Mortuary?
No. Eric?
Funeral home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well done. And,
thank you. I like this quiz.
So, God, you it's like a roller coaster, isn't it, with you, Eric? So... Nathan, I've got this is a possibly another tough one for you, but you're still in the lead, just about. James W. Robison, director of Superstition, was a director of cinematography on which earlier rock slasher?
Rock slasher. Mm. Okay. Let's see. I'll go with Rocktober Blood.
No.
Aw.
So, Joseph.
Was it Terror on Tour?
It was.
That was my second guess. Darn it.
Yes.
Well, do I get a half a point for that being my second guess?
No.
How come Nathan didn't get a second guess?
Why would you get a second guess?
I didn't either. Because
you did in the previous round. You got two guesses.
No, I passed it over to...
Yeah. When you said that, he said, okay, never mind, go ahead. To go to Nathan.
Yes. So, Eric, you kind of just like... It's you just change. It's like a roller coaster, isn't it? One minute you're nice, and one minute you're kind of...
I'm always
up,
nice.
Running around the flat, screaming in your underwear, or back off.
No, or not.
Right, okay. Well, Eric, again, there's another chance for you to redeem yourself. And you still... could win.
Yay.
A few more questions. Oh, no, actually. This is the last question. You can't win. But you could still redeem yourself. So, A, B, or C?
A, please.
A, okay. Although the film takes place across several time zones, in which city does Blaze, the host, the New Wave party in New Year's Evil?
Oh. Do, 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 do. Is she Chicago?
No. Nathan?
Los Angeles?
Yes. Well done.
Oh, that's so obvious. That's why I didn't say Los Angeles.
Okay. Right.
I didn't get two guesses either.
Well, of course
like
you
Joseph
don't get
does
two
every
guesses.
Time. Joseph gets two guesses for every question.
Anyway, I'm just going to put you in a naughty corner, Eric, and move on to Joseph. So, Joseph, do you want B or C?
C.
Okay, this might be quite a tough one. It's can you name, although you should find it on Google, can you name the school in To All a Good Night? The name of the school.
Oh, God. Nathan would know this. I wouldn't know it, but is it St. Mary's?
No, it's not. Okay. Eric, do you want to?
Is it Grange Hill?
No, but good guess. Thanks. Nathan.
It is a saint something, but I don't remember what.
I can hear, who's typing away furiously?
It's Nathan.
Is it?
I'm not even guessing. I've said it's a saint something, but I don't know, so I don't have an answer.
Okay. Well, it was actually, it's not a saint something. It's actually Calvin Finishing School.
Oh, I was absolutely completely wrong. Yeah. And I think that was Eric typing.
It wasn't.
I bet he's trying to throw shade, weren't you, Eric?
Yeah, I think you were throwing all tea, no shade, Eric. Come on.
Mm-hmm. So,
actually, I have no idea what that means. I know it's something to do with that stupid program you watch.
Yeah. Okay. But let's let's Nathan have his moment of glory, see if he can get this last one right. So, in which 1980 slasher did one of Starsky and Hutch appear?
Oh, I don't know who Starsky and Hutch are.
Oh, I know.
That was before my time. I'm only 21. let's see. What? I'm going to say that Starsky and Hutch were in...
just one of Starsky and Hutch. It's Starsky or Hutch.
Oh.
You're saying Last Slumber Party. Well, no, it's a good guess, but no. Completely off the mark, I'm afraid. So, does Joseph?
I know this, but I don't know the title. It's Deadly Lessons?
No. Eric?
I know. I think it's Phobia.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So
do I win?
No, but you come last, so that's the second best thing. Well, the scores and the doors at the end of that are Nathan with 7, Joseph with 5.5, and Eric with 5.
That's so unfair. He didn't say Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the remake. He said Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. Completely different film, made 17 years earlier.
It's a much better film.
Yeah.
Well, all I can say is you'll have to, fight it out amongst yourselves. Or Joseph, are you happy to draw with Eric? I mean, you're both losers, so
I'm fine.
Yeah, okay.
I'm fine.
Okay.
Either way, it's fine.
Well, congratulations to Nathan. Commiserations to Joseph and Eric. So,
very good game, Nathan.
Yes,
I
well
like
done,
winning
Nathan.
Quizzes.
Yeah, you're very good at it, unlike some people. So,
I'm a good winner. I'm just a poor loser. That's all.
Yeah, we're a bit like Eric.
Sure.
I think, should we move on to the feature presentation? I think that's probably wise, isn't it? So, we will come back in a second after we listen to the trailer for He Knows You're Alone.
On the night before her wedding, every girl is alone. Joyce. Nancy. Amy. Tricia, Joan, Debbie. On the night before her wedding, every girl is frightened. And this time, there's good reason. He knows you're alone.
Girl is. Never mind how. I just know who it is.
On the night before the wedding, he knows you're alone. And it's going to be for the very last time.
The settings seem friendly enough. A small town amusement park, an Art Deco movie theatre, a jogger's path through a sunlit glen, a snug home on a suburban side street. But all is not what it seems. Amy, a young bride-to-be, is convinced that someone is watching and following her. She has never actually seen him, but can describe him in every detail. He's tall, gaunt figure, sometimes clutching a butcher's knife. But no one will listen. Her nightmare vision is dismissed as prenuptial nerves. And of course, the trail of mutilated bodies the killer has left behind him are in no fit state to confirm her fears. As her wedding day gets closer, Amy is certain that she's to be the psycho's next victim. On a trip to the amusement park, she finally sees him standing alone, gleaming knife, dripping blood at his side. So that's from the part of the back of the MGM home video, If He Knows You're Alone, pre-cert, which we've had for donkey's years, which was released here in 1982. He Knows You're Alone is a film I've had a kind of slightly checkered past with, I think, is that when I originally reviewed it for Hysteria Lives, I was I liked the film, but I couldn't get past its similarities to Halloween. Whereas revisiting it recently, I have got past that, and I think it's a really neat little thriller in its own right. Now, obviously, it does have an awful lot of similarities to Halloween, certainly from the music, which we heard at the beginning, to the fact that it has three women, close friends in it, a killer who stands up and comes into the shot just like Michael Myers. But to be honest, it's no huge surprise that this was actually one of the first slasher movies out of the stable after Halloween, and it was actually shot in 1979, so fairly soon after Halloween, that became the superstar, kind of the box office phenomenon that it did. But I really liked He Knows You're Alone this time when I watched it, probably a lot more than I did the first time. But I spoke to Armand Mastroianni, the director, and also Kathleen O'Heaney, who plays Amy in the film, and they've got some very interesting behind the scenes stories, so I'm not going to regurgitate them all here. But one of the things that Armand does say, he sort of said it was kind of guerrilla filmmaking in some ways, because I don't think they had permits for places, and they were relying on the kindness of strangers and friends to make the film. So it has, although it is a relatively low budget film, I think it has a sheen to it which belies the, it's low budget. And I really like the setting. I think the characters, again, are very relatable, possibly a little bit simplistic in places, but they're nice characters. You kind of care about them. I'm a sucker for horror films set in the winter, in that kind of cold, chilly time. And this was filmed on Staten Island, and it's got that real feeling of late fall, early winter. The killer is played by Tom Rolfing, who has passed away apparently some time ago. But I think he's really good in it. It's not the look of Michael Myers, although he does ape a lot of Michael Myers' moves. But as I said, when I was speaking to Armand, one of the shots I really liked in the movie was when he was killing somebody, and you just see his face is contorted into real kind of madness and anger, and as he's stabbing somebody over and over and over again. And that shot, I thought, was really good, and also shows that actually there was genuine talent behind the camera. In its very basic, He Knows You're Alone is a kind of a Halloween cash-in, but that's not a bad thing. We wouldn't be doing the show if we were snobby about films in that regard. It's not a perfect film, but I really liked it. I certainly, when it gets towards the end, the chase in the morgue with Amy and the killer, I thought was really, really well done, and quite thrilling. So I two thumbs up from me now. I have changed my mind about it somewhat, even though I have watched it over the years since the early 80s myself, and I've always enjoyed it. But so I'll throw it open to you guys. Eric, what did you think of He Knows You're Alone this time?
This time, yes, I really liked it. But like you, initially when I saw it, probably back in the late 80s, I wasn't thrilled about it. The comparisons to Halloween are there, but to me it feels like, in terms of atmosphere and plot structure, it feels kind of like When a Stranger Calls, in that it has this incredible opening sequence, and then the finale is really good. And then in between, there's probably a bit too much, I don't know, crime and detective movie, shoehorned in there for my liking. Mm. And that's probably why I didn't enjoy it as much back in the day. But I do like it now. When I say it's like When a Stranger Calls as well, it's the way the killer, you know who he is, you know what his motive is, and he walks around in broad daylight. And for me, that's not quite as threatening as the whodunit slashers like My Bloody Valentine and The Prowler and things like that. I like my killers to sort of be masked and mysterious and to hide in the shadows. That's just a personal preference. I just find they're more eerie, and they're more sort of like a horror film, whereas this one, it at times it's like a crime movie almost. There are certainly moments in the film that I think are incredible. I mean, the opening sequence in the cinema, and then there's one scene that I love, which is where Caitlin O'Heaney's character is buying an ice cream in a shop,
and she suddenly gets this really strange look in her face as if she's seen a ghost, and she takes a step back, and in the background we see the guy staring through the window. I thought that was a really clever scene. And it's also, there's one earlier where she's looking in a shop window, there's obviously a camera focused out and she can see herself on the television screens in this electronics shop, and she's like, you know, smiling and that, and then she walks away and we realize the killer has been standing behind her the whole time. Stuff like that is, I think, is really, really effective. And as you said, the last 15 minutes are very much grade A slasher movie-ness. One other thing I love about it, obviously, in the finale, is that Caitlin Mahaney's wearing this fantastic sweater. It's almost like you could fit about 17 people into it. It's a ginormous sweater. Of course, it's famous because it features on the sleeve, the video sleeves, I think, of all the releases of He Knows You're Alone. So, you know, I think you say actually in your review, Justin, that she's one of the few final girls who sort of tries to hide in her own sweater.
Yes.
Yeah. Towards the end of the movie. I do like it, though, especially when it focuses on the three girls in Halloween style. Nancy, Amy and Joyce, as you say, are all, you know, likable characters, even though Joyce is supposed to be this sort of slutty one who jumps into bed with her professor. She's still really likable. And actually, her death scene is quite unusual, I thought, because we see her looking at the camera and she gets this really frightened look on her face, but we never see why. Initially, I thought, oh, that's a bit strange. But looking back, I think it's a touch of genius, to be honest, because it's just really unsettling, I found. The character of Len, who is the detective, and this might be a spoiler, this is a spoiler alert, so spoiler alert, he reminded me that there's a character in The Stepfather, the 1987 Stepfather, who's kind of similar. They're both characters seeking revenge against this killer, and they spend the whole film chasing him. And then as soon as they meet him face to face, they're dead. Like, there's no... Yeah. I find it kind of anticlimactic, the way the detective is killed off so soon after coming face-to-face with the man he's been chasing for so long. And the same thing happened in The Stepfather as well. But I have to say, the ironic twist ending, which is kind of, you know, brings the film full circle, I thought was a touch of genius as well. It's a bit of a downer, I suppose, but I just thought it was very, very clever. So, I mean, it's a great movie. Its rewatchability, I think, is limited for me because it's not quite the roller coaster thrill ride that something like Friday the 13th is, but it's definitely worth a watch.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Nathan, what are your thoughts?
I love He Knows You're Alone, but I am in agreement with Eric, because it's not one of the slasher movies, like, say, one of the Friday the 13th movies, like you said, that I could rewatch, like, over and over and over again, you know, but that doesn't mean that it's not a really, you know, good movie in its own right. Oh my goodness, the score, especially when I was watching it, you know, the opening theme, I was like, you know, it's so obvious, it sounds exactly like the Halloween opening theme, but, you know, I mean... I have to say, I think that most of the film is really good in its own right, because, you know, I think the beginning is very clever, you know, because, you know, we think we're watching one movie and it turns out that's a movie that these other characters are watching. And I want to see that movie. You know, I want to see that movie with a, you know, stocking masked killer wielding a hand scythe, stalking people. I think that would be a fun film also if it had gotten made. But I really, really, like the characters, and I love that chase scene at the end. I mean, it's one of the best chase scenes, you know, that I'd seen in a while. So, you know, I love, to me, I am a big fan of, like, the final girl chase scene in a slasher movie. And I'm always kind of bummed out when a movie doesn't have that. So, you know, I'm very happy with this because it does have that, and it's got a great title. I gave it that too. I like that title.
Excellent. Well, thank you. And obviously, the we've interviewed Russell Todd, who was obviously in Friday the 13th Part 2. He did speak about that briefly, didn't he? Because he's in the opening scene, isn't he?
And he gets hung upside down from a tree in a similar manner to his role in Friday the 13th Part 2.
which is a kind of a spooky coincidence, isn't it? But that, this was made in 1979, so it's a couple of years, or a year maybe, because I was probably Friday 13th part 2.
Yeah, it was the autumn of 1980 when they were filming part 2, so
So so have a, if you listen back, it, I can't remember which episode, well, it's obviously Friday
13th. It was 13th. The Friday 13th part 2 episode, which was a long time back.
Yes, but back in the midst of time. Mm. But
sorry, it wasn't. It was our chopping mall episode.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you, Nathan. How about you, Joseph? What are your thoughts on?
Well, I'm going to pull an Inga myself here and protest a little bit. I always get picked last, and you guys cover everything I want to say, so I really don't have much else to say, but that I agree with Eric and Nathan. I love the circular ending. I love the, you know, the meta film fake out in the beginning, which basically is kind of, you know, ripped off a little bit in Scream 2, or homaged, as you'd call it. I like the I kind of like the irony of the title, He Knows You're Alone, because he's targeting these people who necessarily in a metaphorical sense not alone, because they're getting married, so they're, you know, they're actually with someone. I kind of like, you know, it kind of goes against that, but I like the film. I saw it, the last time I saw it was on Showtime at like 2 in the morning in 1990.
It's Showtime.
In 96 or 97, and I remember not liking it, so I watched it again yesterday, and I liked it. I didn't really care much for the whole detective stuff, but the stalking scenes and, you know, the killer in particular, I thought were really well done. I had a lot more fun, you know, playing, oh my God, it's that person. You know, you got Tom Hanks, obviously, but there's so many people in this film with recognizable faces. James Reborn, he's the professor. Dana Barron is the little kid, and she was in Vacation. Paul Gleason from The Breakfast Club's in it, and a Blink and You'll Miss Him cameo by Steve James from American Ninja. He's the black guy at the station giving the eyewitness account. So I had a little fun, you know, spotting, you know, future celebrities. It's not just Tom Hanks there. But overall, I'd give it like, if I were rating it out of 10, I'd give it like a 4.5, maybe a 5. It's just, it's kind of there. I mean, I love the atmosphere. I love the killer, and the stalking scenes are great. But it's just, it's never really, you know, like something you could, like Nathan said, you can rewatch over and over. It's just like a one-time thing. I'll probably watch it again in another 10 years. But that's pretty much my opinion.
Okay, all right, thank you. And also the other person that's in it, in very briefly, is Amy's fiance, isn't it? James Carroll, who was in The Scaremaker, Girls Night Out.
Yeah, he was Teddy in The Scaremaker, or Girls Night Out. Yeah, he was Phil here. Yeah.
James Carroll. Yeah, well, I mean, I think we have kind of slightly mixed, you know, views on the film, which is, you know, understandable, but it's, you know, I still, you know, I really enjoyed it a lot more this time, as I keep on saying. And it's just, but it's, I think that's some of the thing, the pleasure for me coming back to kind of some of these subgenre films from so long ago, is some of them I haven't seen for a lot, you know, many years, but I tend to be a lot kinder to them when I see them again. And I think it's just because now I've seen so many, my expectations are, I kind of know what to expect, basically, and I'm not comparing everything to Friday 13th and Halloween. And I say, on its own terms, it's you know, I think it's a really entertaining film. And I mean, Armand Mastroianni, who we'll go to the interview with him shortly, he sent me a link to a film called, which we talked briefly about in the interview, called Dark Desire, which he was a fan of horror movies, and the person who wrote it, Scott Parker, was a fan of horror movies. And Dark Desire is a really fun movie. I think it's shot for cable. And it was one of your favourites subjects, Joseph, which is that kind of, like, you know, the From Hell one. This one's called The Roommate from Hell.
Oh yeah, I love From Hell films.
Yeah, so that's definitely worth checking out.
What's and the also, name of it again?
Dark Desire. It's from 2012 or 2000. I think it's 2012-2013. And say, we've got the really interesting interviews with Armand, who is just a wealth of knowledge, and you know, still he obviously still really loves this movie, and it was his first film. And we made contact with Elizabeth Kemp as well, who plays Nancy, I think, in the film. And she wasn't able to get back to us in time for the show, but I have sent her some questions. And she did say, in the message she sent me, she said the life lesson she learned from making this film was don't drink smoke pot anywhere near a fish tank, which I think is a life lesson for us all, isn't it? And of course, this film has the head in the fish tank gag, which I kind of guess Eyes of a Stranger probably borrowed it, do you think?
Yeah, must have,
because that came out, was it 81, wasn't Eyes of a Stranger? Because
it's another 82 film? Wasn't it?
Or yeah. 82 was it? Oh right,
okay. Was it 81 or 82? That's one of those.
Yeah.
So, isn't there
yeah.
another film with is there a head in a fish tank in Night School? No.
It's not in a fish tank, is it in a fish tank? I thought it was in something else.
It's
in that big aquarium, isn't it?
That's right. Well, the head floating down, wasn't it? Was it the head floating down? But it was kind of the whole thing with the whole shtick with the killer in Night School was chopping off the head and putting it in water, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
So there was a kind of in vogue thing of heads in fish tanks. But I think He Knows You're Alone can probably claim to be the film that started that. And it's a real shame, actually. Nancy was quite I liked her character, and she was the one that was romancing Tom Hanks.
Yeah,
who was was very likable in this as well, wasn't he? And also, we almost, and you probably won't believe this if you're listening, but we almost had a chance to interview Tom Hanks about this film. And if that comes off,
he's not lying. We almost did.
We almost did. Yeah. Well, we're very close to. So we know somebody who works with Tom Hanks, and so, but it didn't quite work out. But if it does. Anything does come of it, then we will let you know pretty soon. But shall we go?
I got a question for you guys before you go on to the interview. Mm. I like the final girl in this film, but going towards the circular ending, I do love that ending, but because of how it's set up, because of what happens to her, I kind of didn't really have any sympathy for her when it happened because of what she does to justify that ending. What do you think? I mean, she's so likable through the film, and then she basically, I mean, this is a big spoiler. Basically, she gets exactly the same thing happened to her by someone else, basically taking the film full circle. I kind of felt she deserved it because she kind of let on this guy she was marrying, and she kept going back to her ex. So, I mean, did you have any sympathy for her when it happened to her?
Well, I think it's also in the film. He was screwing around, wasn't he, on her? So he was.
I don't remember that.
I don't remember that either. But he does get constantly described as being a bit of a dickhead.
Yeah. Well, doesn't he go?
Well, when okay. They go, then I take it back. I sympathize with it then.
Yeah, but when they go away, he says,
"We're going." I was kind of just speeding through the film, just pointing out celebrities. So.
Okay. But when he goes away, he says something along the lines, "We'll pick up the girls later." So that led me to think that he was kind of, he's painted as a bit of a bad, a bit of a cad. And so maybe she found that out afterwards. But obviously the whole idea, I kind of guess, was that, that circular ending, which I think, is one of the film's greatest strengths, really, isn't it?
Mm. I did find the character of Marvin, though, her eventual sort of love interest, I found him kind of annoying. And in the end, he proves kind of ineffectual as well in trying to rescue her from the killer. She kind of has to do everything herself, which is and ditto for the cop. I mean, he's kind of ineffectual as well.
Well, I thought
when I was watching it, watching the Don Scardino, the whole time I thought it was Kenny Banya from Seinfeld. He looks just like that character from Seinfeld. I was like, is that Kenny Banya from Seinfeld? It might as well be, because there's 1,000 other celebrities in this film, but it's not.
I thought he's not a particularly good boyfriend or husband material, because he doesn't tell Amy that one of her friends is dead in the morgue. You thought he might have mentioned that to her.
Yeah.
Oh, Joyce is downstairs in the morgue. unless
the killer he wouldn't have planted the body, because he only arrives when she arrives. So.
Yeah, but it was. I mean, that was just like a little thing. Another little touch I really liked, which I thought was it really always makes me laugh, is the two women eating ice cream in that shop.
Oh yeah,
and they're going, "Oh, this is lovely. Oh god, it's gorgeous ice cream." really kind of, you know, making the most of it.
It's all melted. It looks like it's practically yogurt, you know.
But really I do have some trivia about that ice cream shop. Did you know that it only has 29 flavors?
No. Wow.
Yeah. There you
and
go.
What's the connection to, what was that film we kept on going, the connection to? Cheerleader camp, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's a connection to cheerleader camp.
Yeah, yeah. They ate ice cream on that as well. But shall we go to the interview of Armand?
Oh, sure. Let's.
Yes, and we can come back and talk about the film in a minute. But yeah, it was my great pleasure to speak to Armand Mastroianni, and he's such a gracious man and so generous as well. He's, if you've been looking at the Hysteria Lives Facebook group, Armand shared lots and lots of behind the scenes photos from the film. You know, he's just a wealth of knowledge and obviously enthusiasm still for this first movie, and he's got some very interesting tales. So yeah, without further ado, I'll introduce you to my interview with Armand Mastroianni.
Frank, why'd you get me out of bed for this one?
She was getting married, Len. Next week.
I bet it's him.
Oh, wait. Don't jump to any conclusions. I mean, it might be a coincidence.
Coincidence?
Yeah.
No, Frank, he's back. He's giving me a second chance.
How did you come up with the idea for He Knows You're Alone?
He Knows You're Alone came out of a meeting I had with two Broadway producers who were interested in making a low budget horror film. They had some success with a film they had made before called Squirm, directed by Jeff Lieberman, which was sort of a film that was made about a year and a half before, and they had some moderate success with it. And I had written a script which was actually completely different. I had worked on a script with a friend of mine who was a playwright, very much like a movie called Moonstruck with Cher. And it was about two Italian families in Brooklyn, and it came to the attention of the William Morris Agency, and they packaged it, and they put me together with some producers. And the producer, the line producer on the film that they were shooting at that time, came up to me and said, listen, I've seen some of your shorts and everything. Do you want to direct a movie? And I said, of course. I mean, you know, there was no there was no plans for me to direct this script that I had written because I really didn't have any feature credits yet. So he asked me, he said, do you want to direct a film? And I said, yeah. He says, well, I have these two Broadway producers who, you know, want to put up about $75,000 each, and they make these films. They made a film called Squirm, which I was a producer on, and you know, I think they'd like to meet you. I showed them your film, your short films, and they're interested in meeting you. And I said, oh, fantastic. So I had a meeting with them, and they said, okay, what's the idea? And I said, the idea for, and they went, for the film you want to make. So, you know, I didn't know I was being quizzed on what film we were going to make at that moment. So I, you know, I dug into my bag of tricks, and luckily I was in the when I was young, I was in the Boy Scouts, and I was always picked on to tell the campfire stories at night. And I would always I was always telling something really, you know, some kind of scary story about some guy lurking in the woods with a sickle or a knife, you know, killing people. And so I started telling this, and I saw they were mildly interested. And I don't know what possessed me, but at one moment I said, you know, I saw they were uninterested. They were eating lunch, you know, and they said like they had heard this before. And I said, and she's running through the woods, and he's got the sickle raised, and he's chasing her. And we pull back, and we're sitting in a theater, and we're watching this on the screen. Say, suddenly they perked up, and and I said, and the real killer is in the theater sitting behind these two girls. And they liked it, and they started, you know, and then we you know, I said, well, let me work on this a little bit. And they said, yeah, no, we're interested. So I met with a friend of mine who was also very interested in making films, but more he wanted to write them, you know. And we sat down and kicked around the ideas. And then we went back and pitched them the whole story. And they said, let's go. And long story short, we made the film very quickly, like 15 days on Staten Island, because we were originally going to shoot it in Texas. And they had another investor who fell out and they didn't want to make the film anymore. And I said, let's make it. We'll make it on Staten Island. You never out and all that stuff, you know. And sure enough, they said, well, we're not going to go a penny over $150,000, you know. So I said, no, we'll try. We'll do it. We'll do it. And so we did it. We did it in 15 days. And then, you know, the film got finished and they decided they were going to take out an ad in the Variety and announce that it was available for screenings at Cannes. Because at Cannes, you know, they were able, they were lucky the last time in selling the foreign rights to their films.
Hmm.
But it was about a week and a half before the festival in Cannes. And they got a response from some of the studios since they had taken the ad out. And they said, why don't you send the movie to us first? Let's take a look at it while we have time. So they decided, okay, well, maybe let's invest some money and go to Los Angeles and show the movie. And they arrived on a Friday, and they actually carried the – remember, now this is the time when you didn't send – there was no emails and things like that. You couldn't send digital, you know, messages or digital copies to people. They literally carried – these two guys carried these film cans out with them on a plane and brought it to their hotel and then delivered it to 20th Century Fox. But when they got to the hotel, 20th Century Fox, who was the first person in line to see it, said, we need to cancel and bring it in on Tuesday. And they said, well, we're going to lose all these days here while we're here. We're paying for the hotel. Who was next to see it? They said, MGM. All right, let's call MGM, see if they want to see it. So they called MGM and they said, you know, we came in last night and we're here. It was a Thursday at late afternoon. And they said, yeah, bring it in tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., and we'll see it. So they said, okay, great. They brought the film to the MGM studios, dropped it off, and they said, pick it up around noon. Well, they went to pick it up around noon, and they went to the screening room where the projectionist had the cans, and they kind of went in the back, and the room was packed with people, and it was like about a third of the way into the film. And they said, oh, geez, we're early. So they sat in the back, and the minute it ended, the guy shot up out of his seat and said, wow, this picture is amazing. This picture is fucking great. You know, he says, I loved it. And they said, what'd you think? I loved it, man. It scared the shit out of me. So that's what was going on in the room. Then all of a sudden he stopped and he said, excuse me, who are you guys? We're the producers. We came to pick up the film. They said, oh, well, sorry, you're not supposed to be in here. Would you kindly wait outside or go back to your hotel? We'll call you. And they said, but what about the film? We'll call you. So they went back to the hotel knowing something was up here, and they got a call about 3 hours later, 4 hours later, something like that, and they said, look, we want the movie, and we don't want you to show it to anybody else. We'll make a deal. Have your attorneys contact business affairs or so-and-so. And so they were ecstatic. They couldn't believe this. The first shot out, and somebody's buying the movie, and they made a tremendous offer. The offer was outstanding. For their $150,000 investment, they offered $2 million up front, knowing it was, of course. They never told them. And $2 million included all foreign rights, too. So that was a tremendous payday for these guys. You know, look at the profit. Mm. We started shooting this thing, I think, sometime in, late November, early, and we finished. No, I'm sorry. The film was ready. Yes, that's right. Because Cannes is around when? It is around the May?
It's April, May, isn't it? I think, yeah.
April, May, something like that. That's right. Because we had finished just before Christmas on the film and edited it and had it ready for them to take out to Cannes. That's right. So in that short period of time, their investment got turned around and got a return of like tremendous amount of money there. So they were thrilled. They were very, very happy.
Mm.
And the film, the next thing I knew, we got a telephone call, and they said they want to bring you guys all out to Los Angeles for interviews and press things and all that stuff. And so they flew me out and everybody out, and it was my first experience coming out to Los Angeles. And it was terrific. It was the beginning of my career.
Because
that led to a telephone call. They actually offered me a movie at MGM. They offered me a movie called A Stranger is Watching.
Mm.
Oh, and yeah, A Stranger is Watching. That's right, based on the Mary Higgins Clark book.
Mm.
And however, I got a telephone call at the same time from Warner Brothers, and they said, William Friedkin wants to meet you.
Mm.
He saw your film. He was very impressed, and he wants to meet you. And I was like, wow. So I go over to meet him, and he offers me a movie. He says, I want you to make a film for me. And I said, "Oh my God, what, did you stop directing?" And he said, no. I want to start producing, you know, several of these films, and I think, you know, you did a great job, blah, blah, blah. And so, of course, I wanted to go with William Friedkin because, you know, he was like, to me, very, you know, I was a big fan of his work and everything.
Of course, yeah.
And that's how I developed my second film, The Killing Hour, because of him. That's how we got that made. And so, and then, you know, it just became one after another. I was very blessed, I should say, to be able to have that kind of, you know, turnover one after another.
We've made like 62 movies, haven't you? You've made about 62 movies, which is very impressive by anyone's standards. And it all started, didn't it, with He Knows You're Alone? That was your first movie.
That was really my first. I mean, I had some shorts that I won some awards with before that, but He Knows You're Alone was my first feature film that was released theatrically and released by a big company, you know, MGM. So it was like, and I remember going when they released the film, they actually took me from theater to theater where it was playing just to see the reactions of the audience and stuff like that. And it was really quite amazing because I had no idea. At that point, I had seen the film so many times, and I had worked on it and edited it and all that stuff, that I was really disenchanted with it. I felt this film isn't scary. It's never going to scare anybody. I mean, so sophomoric. It's so this, so that, you know. But, my God, I mean, I was so pleasantly surprised to see the reactions people had with it and the effect the film actually had on people. And the thing that really opened my eyes was the fact that, you know, that once you create a square, you know, a rectangle around people, no one knows what exists right outside those perimeters, you know? Mm. And that's what causes the greatest fear to people, that they never know what's lurking just beyond the edge of the frame. Or something as simple as a scene that I shot where she's left alone for a moment and the heroine's left alone for a moment. She runs into the morgue seeking help at the end of the film, and this guy Marvin says, "Stay here, I'll find out who that is," you know, because they hear the door slam. She says, "He's chasing me, he's going to kill me." And she's alone. He goes, call the cops, and he leaves. And she steps around the desk, and behind her is this gigantic window, and it was pitch black, night out. And people started screaming in the theater, "Get away from the window, get away." Now, I had no intent, I had no plans of making her do that. I just said, "Go around the desk and dial," you know, not thinking that the window would become a threat in the scene. And yet it did. And it was amazing. So I learned a lot making that film. And I've learned a lot at making each film. Every film I make, I still learn something. I try something, I get an idea, or I want to implement some kind of new way of visualizing something. And, you know, you try it and you see if it works or it doesn't. But it's an incredible process, because you're constantly, you know, learning things, and you're learning the effect that the visual medium has on people. And it's quite amazing.
Of course. I mean, He Knows You're Alone, when it's released on video way back in the 80s, early 80s, which is how I saw it originally, it actually has that shot of Caitlin O'Heaney being attacked by Tom Rolfing by grabbing through the door. So it was quite iconic, that image. And also the film's got some quite famous fans, isn't it? I seem to remember you mentioning, like, Martin Scorsese. You bumped into him, and he was quite a fan of the film, wasn't he?
That's right.
Mm. And
he remembered it. He was actually in New York City. I was walking on 7th Avenue, and I walked by, and I see him on his knee, one knee, and he's kind of staring, you know. And I said, you know, to notice him while people are just walking by, because anything can happen in New York City, and people continuously walk by. But I happened to notice him, and I said, "Oh my God, that's Martin Scorsese!" So I walked over, and I said, "Excuse me, Martin Scorsese?" He said, yeah, what? I said, "My name is Armand Mastroianni." He shot up and he went, "Oh, He Knows You're Alone. I love that fucking movie. The Knife in the Seat. Oh, my God, it was fun. Hey, cut. And I'm going, what are you doing? You know, and he was shooting King of Comedy. And he had all these hidden cameras on 7th Avenue. And Robert De Niro was like a block and a half away. I didn't see him. He was walking toward us. And he waved him over. He says, "Come over here, Bobby. I want you to meet somebody." And it was amazing. It's just you know, I actually walked in and disrupted the shot, so without knowing about it.
It's amazing. And did you ever watch Scream 2 and the beginning of that?
Yeah, well, you know, I worked with Wes.
Okay.
And we did a series together. We did Nightmare Cafe.
Mm.
And he always said, you know, someday I love that idea. And they used that in the movie.
Mm. Mm.
They used that opening, the scene, the knife in the seat and all that.
Of course, because it went on to inspire even more. There was Anguish, which was set in the cinema, and Matinee, and Lamberto Bava's Demons, and there was lots of ones that it inspired so much, didn't it? And to think that came from you kind of thinking very quickly on your feet in a meeting to it's funny how those things can spark so much.
Right, right. And then, but a lot of the sequences in Scott Parker, who's the writer, was also very instrumental in creating. I mean, we were talking about the idea of, like, the girl leaning out the window and the guy being out there lurking with the knife, you know, and every time she'd throw her head back, we think he's going to slice her throat. But, you know, it's the build-up. It's the teasing of the audience with those elements that makes a good thriller, because, you know, you can pay it off very quickly and then it's over. It's like, of course, you know, the whole thing about Hitchcock saying, you know, if you have two people walk in a room and they start talking about baseball and suddenly an explosion goes off and they're dead, you know, the shock only happens for a second. But if we see the bomb under the table from the beginning, and then these two guys walk in, our nerves are on edge because we know this bomb is going to go off. It's ticking, and they're oblivious to it. So, I mean, that's far better than just having the thing go off and realize that momentary shock. So it's the teasing, the stretching out of the moments that really get to people, you know.
Of course, and at the time you made the film, because I think in the commentary on the DVD you did with Scott Parker, you were sort of saying it was around the time Friday the 13th came out, and you purposely sort of made it less gory.
I hadn't seen Friday the 13th. Mm. It hadn't been released yet. What I did see was Halloween, which I was impressed with, which I thought, wow, this is clever. I mean, look, you never quite see anything happening. It's like, again, we go back to Hitchcock. It's like Hitchcock saying, you know, you never quite see the knife hit her in Psycho. I mean, but yet it's so terrifying. So I said, let me try doing something like that, because I just realized how, effect heavy and makeup heavy those other films are. You know, you really got to have great people working for you to make those things believable. And all those special effects and, the gore and all that stuff. But I think, not to be an elitist, but I just think it's scarier what you don't see.
Mm.
You know,
well, especially,
I think what your mind can imagine is far worse than what you do see, because sometimes it looks hokey. You know, if it's not done really well, it just looks fake, you know, and I've seen that where it just takes me out of the movie. You see the artistry of the makeup artist as opposed to the artistry of the director trying to scare you to death there. I mean, you see all the gimmicks. You see the fake head or the little patch on the throat as something shoots through it. Mm. You know, I was trying to avoid some of that.
I
did something where I had Mark Sjostrom. I worked with Mark Sjostrom, who's a tremendous, a puppet maker and a special effects guy. And we did a film called Supernaturals where, we had all these zombies and these corroded bodies walking around and everything. So, and I think he did a pretty good job with that. I mean, I think they did an excellent job, I should say. So I was more comfortable, showing that, rather than just creating, the promise of those walking, the creatures walking around in the dark, and although I did, for some reason I still think that's very scary. I mean, the Val Lewton movies, like the cat people and all, just the hint of something there is. I mean, again, with Jaws, you saw when you didn't see the shark and you knew there was this mass under the water that was going to swallow you up, I think that was terrifying. But when you started to see it toward the end, it becomes familiar and you, it doesn't have the same impact. It doesn't have the same scare factor, you know?
Well,
you know, it's something you're familiar with now. You know what it looks like. You know its size. You know its... I just think less is more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, I mean, certainly, just going on to the killer, Tom Rolfing, who there's a shot in the movie where he kills the professor, I think it is, and you just see that shot of him stabbing and stabbing and stabbing, and his face is so contorted that at the time you had, certainly with something like Halloween, you had that very, Michael Myers was very kind of, well, not placid, but completely emotionless, whereas Tom Rolfing was this kind of, I don't think he actually speaks at all, does he, in the movie, but he has this kind of very twisted face.
Tom was the sweetest guy in the world, and it was, I was constantly, he's no longer with us, he's passed away, but he was such a gentle soul. He's just very tall, and we gave him this funny haircut, and I kept saying to him, I said, Tom, in order for you to scare us, you've got to be deranged. You've got to be, there's got to be something off about you. If you're normal and rational, you know, you take away a lot of the fear from us because we think you're someone that we could possibly talk to and, you know, convince, you know, you're doing the wrong thing. But you've got to be this kind of like machine that just goes out there and the anger and the rage inside of you has just consumed you. So you've got to, like, distort your face. You've got to pull your teeth back. You've got to look at them with vacant eyes. You know, those empty eyes sometimes. And he had these great eyes, so I said, we've got to keep photographing those eyes a lot because they're just so, you know, there's just something about them that evokes fear, you know? If somebody was walking down the street just staring at you like that without blinking, you know, it's kind of unnerving. So, and he's just a great, he came, I saw somebody ask, where did you find him? Well, the two guys that produced the movie were Broadway producers, Edgar Lansbury and Joe Beru. They had produced shows on Broadway like American Buffalo and David Mamet's, American Buffalo and a couple of other. And these, some of the actors that ended up in the film were people who were, you know, either had secondary roles in those shows or they would recommend them and they would come in to see me for the casting session because we really didn't have a casting director. It was such a low-budget film. I was doing the casting. And that's, again, how Tom Hanks came in. You know, I was actually having lunch. I'm sure you know this story because I've said it on the thing. And he was early and I met him and I just got so taken with him. I found him really charming. I said, we need somebody like this in the movie. And, you know, it was one of those issues where they just didn't want him. They said, the guy's not, you know, he has no credits and he's not even in the Screen Actors Guild. We can't hire him. And I said, no. So, you know, I fought for him. They finally said, I don't want to hear you anymore. Let's put him in him and give him a secondary role. And that's how that happened. But it was, and it became for me a process of discovery for a lot of actors because over the years, that's what I've done. I've insisted on sometimes sitting in on the pre-reads that they do, some of the casting directors that later on I worked with. And they said, well, why do you want to come to this? It's boring. There's a lot of bad actors that are going to come in. I said, because you never know. Sometimes I see something that I can work by someone or, you know, something in a quality in that person that I really want to work with, you know, I want to use with this new character. And sometimes an actor will inspire me to, you know, change the character a little bit to accommodate who they are because they bring so much life to it, you know.
And is it right that you liked Tom Hanks so much, his character and Tom Hanks as an actor, that he was actually meant to be killed in the film, but you decided not to?
Yes. At one point he was to be killed and we said, no, let's not kill everybody. Let's keep him alive because I think Elliot is a guy that we, you know, he's just this kind of nerdy guy that we like, you know? And it was so funny because, he was supposed to be this object of their desire, you know? And Tom was a little geeky looking in those days. He had the curly hair and he was like, you know, and I remember at one screening where Caitlin O'Heaney and Elizabeth Kemp are sitting down, they're jogging, and they go, there he is, he's so cute. And somebody in the theater says, he's not cute. And I said, well, there you go. So much for taste.
Well, absolutely. And talking of a kind of not missed opportunities, but I think you sent a commentary also when you're talking to Scott Parker, saying that Harry Reams, the famous porno actor, was at one point, he was considered for a role, wasn't he, in the film?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They all came in. I mean, we got everybody.
Oh, really? Okay. So okay.
Harry, who's now this, like, what is he, an evangelist or something?
I don't know.
He changed his life completely.
Mm.
Yeah.
That would have been an interesting. It would have been interesting if being.
Oh yeah,
but, I mean certainly
he would have impaled them. I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, certainly around to that time, there was people like Marilyn Chambers, wasn't there, who were working.
Yeah,
with David
Cronenberg, Marilyn Chambers behind the green door, and
yeah,
and
yeah, she worked. She worked.
Ivy Snow Girl.
Absolutely, but she went on to work with Dave Cronenberg, didn't she, on Rabid and Shivers, I think. And
yep,
so
yep,
there was
yep,
a lot of that happening
Cronenberg
at the time. But talking, actually, I seem to also remember you saying that the producers, did they force you to add a little bit of nudity and they wanted a bit more blood? Is that, did you have
yeah,
that kind of thing?
Yeah, they did.
On?
They did. They said, well, how are we going to sell this film? I mean, you know, if we don't have nudity and we don't have blood, how are we going to sell it? You know, and... You know, I don't know what it was about me at that time and still is. I think that, to me, I always feel that, like I said, less is more. I mean, you don't have to be obvious with everything.
Mm.
And I don't know, I just felt obvious is cheap to me. I just think, I used to like films that had me think more than just, you know, dished it all out.
Mm.
But, you know, look, there's an appetite for everything and people's tastes vary, so... they just wanted some protection. They felt that, you know, if we had nudity, at least the foreign market at least would be appeased. And if there was some, you know, some really more, you know, the killings were a little more graphic, we'd also, you know, it'd be more saleable rather than something that's a little less obvious, something that a little more, say, esoteric or something that's just... You know, all, you know, implied.
Of course. And it, I mean, you would sort of say, I think you've said that it's kind of almost making this movie as kind of guerrilla filmmaking, wasn't it? Because it's like 15 days with all the, especially towards the end, with the stunts, the car stunts and things like that, which you would be difficult to film in quite a high budget movie, but let alone in a lower budget movie. And to do that in 15 days is quite incredible. I mean, did you, again, in a commentary you talk about, basically, you were kind of, a lot of it was made on favors and people helping out and happenstance, wasn't
it? Absolutely. A lot of favors, a lot of friends and people just coming in and doing, like, grunt work. But again, you know, what it does do as a filmmaker, it teaches you to shoot very quickly.
Mm.
And since the budget was so low, you didn't have a lot of films, so you had to do like what they called quick action, quick sticks. So in other words, go action, you know, like they'd slap the sticks and you go action, because those extra seconds between action, you know, or take one, clap, and the director, you know, saying, okay, now action. Those extra seconds mean film is going through the camera. You know, and I was made very much aware of that at the beginning, where they said we have only this much film, and you're not getting any more, so
okay,
it's got to be, you got to shoot it and not too many takes, one or two takes and out, and that taught me more or less to be very economical and you know what you want. Don't start experimenting. Of course, today we have a luxury when we're shooting digital. It's, you know, you leave the camera running and you walk in the shot and you start talking to the actors. I mean, which makes a nightmare for the editors, because they got to wade through all this garbage, you know, that you're not going to use. But it's a whole different world. And you know, cutting film was a whole different process than cutting on a computer today. We used to sit in the editing room and you know, slap the film together and put tape on it and watch it. And I would always be aware of when the splices were coming up, because you'd see it go through the projector. You'd see, psh, you know, you'd hear it. And
yeah,
it would always distract me because I was afraid the film was going to tear, which happened often. And today it's a whole new process. You don't do that. You don't, you know, and today you can almost realize your effects right then and there, rather than wait for it to be sent to the lab and see how that fade looks or the dissolve or the whatever effect you're trying to achieve that has to be done, you know, later on. You have so many advantages, and this is what I say to a lot of filmmakers today, young filmmakers who ask me, like I said, today you have so many advantages at your disposal. Hmm. Use them. I said, you can go out and make movies on your cell phones right now. I mean, just to show what you can do, the concept, put a concept. It's not about the technology. It's really about the concept. How good is the story? How good is the film? What are you trying to say? You can use the best equipment in the world and make a lousy film.
Hmm.
And, you know, I always hear, you know, from other filmmakers, oh, did you see the dolly shot, or did you see that incredible Steadicam shot? Yeah, but it means something to us, but the average Joe out there who goes to the movies doesn't care. That doesn't affect them the way it does filmmakers. So I say, you know, be honest with what the story is about. Make the story be number one. Make the visual elements of the story relatable, and make sure you're telling the story you want to tell and not showing off with, hey, look at how long I could sustain this shot, or look at the dolly shot that I just created, because it becomes a technical film then and not a personal film.
Of course. And yeah. I mean, talking about the economy of making He Knows You're Alone, I mean, from what you said, were there any scenes or shots or film things that you can remember that were cut out for any reason?
Oh, I don't think very much was cut out of that film because of the fact that we didn't shoot that much. You know,
exactly,
No, I mean, little mistakes and things like that were cut out. No, I don't think there are any scenes missing.
Hmm.
We might have trimmed one or two things down just a little bit within some dialogue cuts and stuff, but nothing major. There are no scenes. There are no deleted scenes or anything like that. We just didn't have the time to shoot it or the budget to indulge.
Of course.
Later on, there are films that I've done that, you know, have had, you know, sequences that we've removed and stuff like that. But He Knows You're Alone was certainly a learning experience for me, because it was my first 35mm film. I had shot on 16 before that. And, you know, it actually allowed me to move ahead and shoot my next one and my next one and my next one. You know, it just became an ongoing process then. And thank God for that. That was really good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we move on a little bit to just a few more questions, and just about your career, because you carried on, didn't you, obviously, with The Killing Hour, The Clairvoyant, wasn't it? And then obviously The Supernatural and Cameron's Closet and other sort of genre pieces. Were you a horror fan when you were younger? Is it something you were interested in? Because you've had such an eclectic
career. Absolutely. I was definitely a horror fan, but I also loved all kinds of movies. I mean, I wasn't limited to just the horror genre. I loved great, I was a fan of the big epic movies too. And I liked great dramas, you know, stuff that emotionally moved me. So I think that's one of the reasons why I was, you know, and again, I feel blessed that I was able to diversify, given you mentioned Wes. Wes and I had that conversation one time. He says, you know, wow, I'm kind of jealous, envious of you. I said, well, what do you mean? Why? I mean, I should be envious of you. And I am. He said, no, but he says, you make a lot of very diversified films. You know, you can make a comedy, you make a love story, you can make a thriller, you can make a horror movie, an action film. I said, and he says, and I'm stuck in this genre of horror films. And I said, well, that's what you do so well, and that's what people expect from you. You know, it's like going to see this latest Woody Allen movie, which is terrific, but not knowing anything about it. You're expecting a Woody Allen movie, and this turns out to be a disturbing film about someone whose life is falling apart. So it's a little bit off center for what you expect from Woody Allen. So people, fans, expect Wes Craven to deliver horror films and thrillers of that nature. And when he tried to make a film like Music from the Heart with Meryl Streep, nobody went to see it. And yet it was a very good film. He just wasn't perceived to be that kind of a director.
But I think it's,
I was somehow given the opportunity to move from, yes, the first few were all, you know, in that genre. They were all and then I got hired to do Friday the 13th, Tales from the Dark Side, then War of the Worlds, and then suddenly I get a telephone call about somebody wanting me to do a legal thing. which was called, I think, Reasonable Doubts or something like that. And I said, oh, that's interesting. So I moved on to that, and that led to something else and something else. And then I started making movies about domestic violence and you know, using some big TV stars and stuff, doing this in television, of course. And that started to broaden my resume and the kinds of films I was, you know, being considered for, because you do get categorized in this business. You think of Wes Craven, you think of him as a horror director, you think of Alfred Hitchcock, you think of him as a thriller director, you think of, but a guy like, say, all right, let's pick Steven Spielberg, has done it all. He does, you know, War of the Worlds, and he can do The Color Purple, or he can do Lincoln, you know, I mean, and Jaws, and the action films. So I think I kind of like that kind of repertoire more than just being categorized as doing one kind of film. It's like, too, when I was doing series, quite frankly, after a while I'd get bored, because it was, we did the show this week, now we're doing it again next week, and it's the same actors, and it's just a few little changes in what happens to them. And then we do it again and again and again, and there's no, like, way to move on and create something new, you know, which is what I can do with a film. Each film I can give it a different look, a different feeling, a different style. When you're in series, you're pretty much, you know, committed to their style and structure.
I mean, did you?
And even with Dark Shadows, I mean, but Dark Shadows was a blessing for me, because that came out of my work on Friday the 13th. I got a telephone call from Dan Curtis and said, "Listen, I really loved your shows. I saw a couple of them and on Friday the 13th, I like the way you shoot and all that. I want you to come out and do this show with me." And I went, wow, okay. And so that was another experience.
Of course. And did you've returned to the thriller genre, haven't you, fairly recently? Because you very kindly sent me a link to watch your film from last year, Dark Desire. So did you enjoy going back? Did it feel like kind of going back to something, you know, did you enjoy going back to doing that kind of film?
Absolutely. I mean, because again, that's more the kind of film I like. I like when, you know, everything has a sense of reality to it, and this could happen, you know, whereas in some of the horror films, you know, it is extraordinary and almost impossible for that to happen, but it works within the context of the premise you've set. In these films, you have to try to keep it, you have to keep a reality that people can identify with in order for them to be interested, because if it starts getting too extraordinary, it just feels, wow, this is just manipulative. So I like that, and I like creating tension and thrill, and you know, you know, creating a thriller that exists in our everyday, you know, in what would happen to you and me during the day. Suddenly, in bright daylight, something's happening that is very unnerving, very unsettling, you know, and you can identify it with it. An audience would identify with it and say, "Oh my God," you know, and then become involved. So I like utilizing, you know, I like doing thrillers that are very, you know, connected to reality, as opposed to far, you know, to science fiction or something that's extraordinary. Even the action films, I mean, you go over the top in these films because that's what people want to see. They want to see, you know, extraordinary car chases and, you know, cars flying through the air and stuff like that. Because most of the times, if that actually happened, the person would be dead, you know, and yet they crawl out of the car and go running down the street and chasing and shooting at each other. Nobody gets hit by bullets, but, you know, they've shot about 2,000 bullets at each other. And, you know, but it's the genre. It's that kind of, you know, film that you know, you, the premise you set up. I instead like doing the stuff that's really based on in reality, and hopefully, you know, you could believe this is really happening.
Of course. And
believe, like, that character would become, you know, that film was a little bit inspired by the Patricia Hinesworth, is it Hinesworth, the Talented Mr. Ripley?
Oh, right. Yeah, it's, I can see that, definitely, yeah.
And, it's about somebody who's devoid of a personality, somebody who's longing so much to be somebody, has nothing going on inside of him, and he just clings to the first person that shows any interest in him. And, I think it's the premise of that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes it's the monsters that are much more believable, far scarier, aren't they, than the kind of latex and the fantasy ones, because you can imagine that kind of sociopath, that kind of person who is essentially a vacuum and just wants to take on other people's lives. I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed Dark Desire, and sort of urge people listening to sort of check it out. And what have you got coming up? Because I think you're doing a film about the Mexican miners?
Yeah, that's in talks right now. I mean, okay. That's not officially happening yet. And, there's a couple of other projects that I'm developing, and a series possibly for television that seems very possible. So, but again, it's more character-driven piece.
Yes.
And, you know, of course, a good thriller comes along. Of course I'd want to make one. You know, I've always loved that. And I've always loved, for example, another favorite film that I did for me when I was even reluctant to do it when I got the script was a film called The Ring, shot in Prague and London and Vienna. And it was all about the 1930s and 40s in Germany and about a family trying to escape. And it just, wow, it was just, I had so much to work with there. And it was a big 4-hour movie, you know, for NBC. And then right after that, I went from that to doing a science fiction film called Invasion, which was another 4-hour film with Luke Perry about aliens coming down, you know. So there you go. It's a diversified resume.
Yes, it certainly is. And just one last question a couple of questions very quickly on He Knows You're Alone. Was there ever any talk of a sequel at the time?
Many times. Right now there's a talk of a sequel.
People keep
calling and saying, but you know what the problem is? MGM sold its library to Turner. Ted Turner sold it then to New Line, who then it got taken over by Time Warner.
Right.
And Warner owns it. And there's a complicated line of there, and Warner's will not make it, whereas New Line wants to do it, and they've been in talks. People have been calling, and I don't even know if I would direct it. I mean, I think probably there's somebody out there today, one of these younger guys that come along and probably do a great job with it. I mean, I saw a film that a friend of mine made years ago, and it got remade, and I thought it was just as good, called When a Stranger Calls.
Yes.
It was a different take on it, but it was all in 90 minutes in this house, you know, whereas that one had a beginning that shocked you. And then, of course, the very, very end. But the middle was the police investigation. So, you know, I think there are people out there to reinterpret your film and do a great job with it, you know.
So it wouldn't be a continuation. It would be more of a reimagining or a remake of the source material.
Yeah, I really don't know what it would be, because I don't know. Where would you go with that? I mean, the guy's dead at the end. She knows you're alone this time, you know. She comes back as the insane one, you know. A friend of mine, Bill Lustig, is doing, they did a remake of his film Maniac. They're trying to remake Maniac Cop. And, you know, and it's basically, he said, you know, it's a retelling of the story, but only, rethought out a little bit more and re-modernized a bit.
I think he's
comfortable with that. I don't know what I would say to He Knows You're Alone if you're going to just remake the film, the same movie. I mean, why? Come up with something new.
Yeah, of course. Well, it'd be interesting to see if someone tried it. Sometimes it works. I mean, I think with Maniac, from what I hear, I haven't seen it yet, but I know a lot of people really like the remake. Whereas sometimes, usually remakes can usually lose quite a lot of what made the original special in the first place.
Especially if the first film is so well known.
Yes.
You know, the remake is only, you know, it's like I could never understand why Gus Van Sant remade Psycho frame for frame, only in color. I mean, what was that about? I mean, you knew everything that was about to happen. There was no surprise in that film. There was nothing. It was like watching Psycho in color with different actors.
Yes.
It was like an exercise, I guess, he just wanted to do, but it just, I didn't think it was a very successful film. I mean, the other films that I thought were better, the ones that Psycho 2, Psycho 3, whatever, at least they tried to fill in the rest of the story or tell the backstory.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting. We'll see what happens, because I know obviously they've remade all the Friday 13th and Halloween and My Bloody Valentine and all the kind of staple mates.
Even Hills Have Eyes and stuff like that. You know, they've redone all those, and it's just, I think it's masturbatory. That's it.
I think come up
with something new, and I think everyone's so afraid of doing that because, you know, they just want to cash in on what they think is going to make money.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I think there's been a fear. I mean, they talk about saying younger audiences will not watch black and white movies, for instance, which was one of the excuses I think Gus Van Sant had about Psycho. But I don't understand that. I mean, I know certainly some people prefer the remakes to, say, Halloween to the original, which I can't understand. But then I'm in my 40s, so I'm probably not the right demographic for the remake crowd. But it would be interesting to see, but it's been absolutely fascinating talking to Armand, and I know you're a very busy man, so I don't want to keep you any longer, but I think people, fans of the movie, which, does it surprise you that it's still got such a following today?
Oh, yes, of course it did. Mm. It did, and it's so rewarding to see people still think about it. You know, I mean, there's so many choices today of what people can watch and stuff, and if you go back and watch that, it's, well, thank you. And yeah, no, it's been a pleasure speaking with you too, Justin. Thank you so much for showing interest in it and for the call.
Too bad they don't have a roller coaster.
Thank God for small things.
Don't you like to be scared, Abe?
No.
Most people do, actually. I mean, like to be scared. It's something primal, something basic. Horror movies and the roller coasters and the House of Horror ride.
I want to go on that next.
And you can face death without any real fear of dying. It's safe. You can leave the movie or get off the ride with a vicarious thrill and the feeling that you just conquered death. One hell of a first-class rush.
Don't tell me you're a psych major.
Oh, a good deductive guess. I'm most interested in fear, the emotion of fear. For example, why, after seeing Psycho, were so many people afraid to take showers?
Not me. I never saw the movie.
You were afraid, right?
You bet.
And thank you again to Armand Mastroianni for a very interesting interview and sort of taking the time to talk to me earlier this week, or was it last week? But we've also got another interview coming up, and I was thrilled to talk to Caitlin Ahini about her time making the film, and that's going to be coming up shortly. But we're going to talk a little bit about background of the film. Obviously, Armand covered quite a lot of it in his interview. But Joseph, do you have anything?
No, not really.
I thought you had something thing about the ice cream shop.
Mm.
I did. I said it only had 29 flavors.
Mm. Oh, okay.
What about you, Nathan?
It was made in 1980.
But it wasn't, was it?
No. So my trivia is even wrong. So.
Yeah. But thank you. Well, what about you, Eric?
Okay, only a small bit of information. Dana Barron, who plays Diana, the little sister, Joseph's already mentioned she was in Vacation, which I think was called National Lampoon's Vacation to us over here. She was also in the third season of one of my favorite TV shows, Beverly Hills 90210, where she totally seduced David Silver in the beach house and broke up his relationship with Tori Spelling. They bonded over their love of the George Michael song, I Want Your Sex. So there you go. She was an absolute tramp in it.
I want your sex. Sorry.
Yeah. And I think he was singing that to ladies back in the day. Don Scardino, who plays Marvin, he was also in Squirm. He was the final boy in Squirm, which I think is a really good movie. It's just come out on Blu-ray over here in the UK and Ireland. I might pick it up, but I do find it kind of stomach-churning because, I don't know, there's something icky about worms, I find. The special effects in He Knows Your Lawn were done by Tassos Stavarakis, who was Tom Savini's assistant. He worked famously, of course, on Dawn of the Dead and Friday the 13th, and his hands doubled for Mrs. Voorhees in the decapitation scene at the end of the first movie. In 1980, this was the 83rd most successful movie at the box office. It wasn't that far behind Motel Hell, which was 78th. The most successful horror film that year was The Shining at number 14. It grossed $4.8 million from what I can gather. It was released on the 29th of August 1980, when I would have been 6.5.
So I was way too young to go see this in the cinema. And that, I think, is all I have for background.
Okay, thank you. I've got a few bits here. It was released in UK on November the 30th, 1980. So I've got an advert down here, and it was released with the this is one of the films that provoked quite a lot of controversy from various people, including Siskel and Ebert, and very much the kind of scene, the whole Women in Peril thing. And when you actually look at the artwork for the film, the most famous one is the close up of Caitlin Heaney pulling up her jumper over the top. But there's also another one that's a kind of riff on that, where you've got her cowering, or actually it's not actually her, but it's somebody pretending to be her cowering in the corner putting up her jumper, and in the foreground there's a man holding a knife. And so that was, you could see why, I think this is one of the films that got protested by feminist groups. But actually the film, as Armand says, you know, he's shied away from particular gore and violence, although or sex indeed, and although the producers made him put some in, which is why you kind of got that kind of the nude shower scene with Nancy. The film was released all across the world, actually, because it had MGM backing. And I found some great little titles. In Hungary, it was called Killer Rendezvous, which makes it sound like going out for a bite to eat, or, you know, doing lunch. In Germany, it was just called Panic. In Brazil, it was Trail of Corpses. In France, it was released as Bloody Wedding. And the film was originally titled Blood Wedding, but there was a Spanish production released the same year called Blood Wedding, but the film was MGM rechristened it He Knows You're Alone when it tested very well with audiences. And in Greece, it was The Assassin with the Dagger. Let's have a look, see what else. Somebody on IMDb said that Tom Hanks was talking about this film, and he said the full title was He Knows You're Alone, So Don't Go in the House Because He's Going to Kill You with a Knife. But I think that was probably a joke.
It probably was.
It probably was a joke, yes. What else have we got here? The film, the alternate titles they went through, and apparently Tom Hanks was very helpful coming up with them. It was Blood Wedding, Shriek, and The Uninvited were several titles that were talked about. It was filmed in a mere 15 days, and the entire production process from writing to final cut of the film was done in 4 months. Tom Rolfing was cast because of the intense look in his eyes. And also, I think on the commentary, I don't think Armand says it in the interview, and I can't remember because I haven't listened to the interview this week, but he says that it often gets confused with When a Stranger Calls, which does have quite a few. It was released the year before, but it has a quite similar setup, doesn't it, with the detective angle. The producers, Georges Méliès and Robert de Milia, cameo as the angry drivers that shout at the detective during the chase scene. And obviously it was shot entirely on Staten Island. So there's not that many slasher movies made around kind of New York area, really, is there? I'm trying to think of...
Maniac?
Maniac and...
New York Ripper, obviously. Yeah,
actually, and thinking about it, there's quite a few, isn't there? There's
City in Panic. City in Panic, is it New York?
I don't think it is. Isn't that Chicago? But I might be wrong.
I don't remember.
But there's Nightmares and a Damaged Brain is New York, isn't it? And also, God, what's that? What's the film?
Sleepaway Camp?
Cheerleader Camp. Possibly Cheerleader Camp. But what else have we got? I've got some press books which I love, these old press books that especially the ones that come up with ideas of how to sell the movie, because they were obviously produced for cinemas, and they've got all these things like stage a midnight screaming, or classified under murder, and sort of basically there's a terror movie quiz here as well, which you can do, which I won't do.
Eric will lose
and might have a meltdown. Well, I'll tell you, you'll probably get this one, Eric. I'll read you one of the things. This, it says, here is a quiz which spotlights the terror of MGM's He Knows You're Alone by recalling the great scare scenes of the past. Use this quiz as a radio or newspaper contest linked to your opening, Eric, there you go. And be sure to reward the winners with two passes to your first performance so they won't have to go alone. So, Eric, I'm going to test you on this one. Jack Nicholson stars in this current shocker as a frenzied family man who suffers cabin fever when he takes a job as a janitor at an isolated Grand Hotel. Can you name the movie?
The Shining.
Is it The Shining?
The Shining. Okay, I'll give you one, Joseph, as well, as it were.
you lucky little boy.
Boy, I wouldn't put that in my mouth. If I were you, it might explode.
In this science fiction thriller, an alien creature crash-landed near a frozen outpost. Scientists carted it back to their post in a block of ice, but terror began when the ice melted. What film's that?
Is it the Thang?
The Thong. The Thong, yes, that's the one. Nathan, so you're not left
horror thong.
That's the horror thong. Or take a peek. This peekaboo thriller starring Jamie Lee Curtis in a night of trick-or-treat terror. Her worst moment came in a closet where she fortified herself against a murderous maniac. The Horrifying Holiday is also the title. Any ideas?
You give me all the difficult questions, Justin. I believe that's the holiday that's coming up.
Yes,
which
Christmas.
Will be Thanksgiving.
First of October.
You know, yeah. Trivia about that. When I was a kid, I made a film called Hackoween.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
Was it good? Did it have the shoe rack in it?
No. Like, the killer was a broom and the mop was the final girl.
Wow, that sounds thrilling.
That sounds amazing.
I think I was like 8 or 9 years old.
Is the broom still alive? Can we get an interview with it for the podcast?
they've sadly passed on.
Oh, that's a shame.
It had a great final of Friday the 13th, you know, jump scare at the end, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right. Gosh. Well, have you still got it somewhere?
No, I thought I still had it on a VHS tape somewhere, but this was long before I became so polished with Voodoo Massacre and the old Federal Massacre, of course.
Fair enough. Excellent. Well, I've just got a couple of other things here, which I thought was this promotion thing is one that says classified under murder. It says wedding bells bring out the sentiment in everyone, but when the nuptials forecast terror, the ceremonies become a spellbinding affair with death. That's the idea behind this campaign. Place an ad in a classified section of your local newspaper that reads, "You are cordially invited to attend the most entertaining wedding of the year. The bride has been groomed for murder, and the ceremony could be the groom's last rites. For further information, call." So this idea that they would put classified ads into newspapers to sell the movie, I thought it was quite sort of tickled me. And it says the phone number, of course, is a recorded message to pique the caller's interest even further. With a background of ominous wedding bells or a minor key wedding march, the message is, everybody loves a wedding except for the psycho who slashes the knot before it's tied, and he knows you're alone. The macabre story of an uninvited guest who turns a bridal shower into a bloodbath and the wedding party into a wake is now playing at the name of the theatre. Insert here, come to the celebration if you dare. It's a want ad, sure to bring results. So they're great, these things. And another thing they have here is about putting it says you might putting something at the bottom of your buttered popcorn cups, so when patrons look for the last few kernels, they get the unexpected warning and plan to stock a supply of fortune cookies to give your patrons for several weeks before your opening. Of course, each fortune cookie will contain the same chilling prophecy: he knows you're alone. So
Eric, have you ever cut a hole in the bottom of your popcorn tub?
I'm not a big popcorn fan.
Are you not?
No. It's not fattening enough for me.
Okay. The other thing, just the last thing, I'll try and post some of these on Facebook, but it says the idea of decorating the lobby, and it says, don't lose your head, use it for a display. One of the scariest moments in He Knows You're Alone explodes when an unwary girl suddenly comes face to face with a psycho and loses her head. That chilling scene is inspiration for this demonic display idea that will itself turn heads, your patrons. Install a large tropical fish tank in your lobby, complete with a gravel bed, plant life, an aerator, and of course fish. Then place a mannequin's head, its eyes open, wide, and hair billowing out on the bottom. For further shock value, place your aerator so the bubbles seem to escape from the mannequin's lips. And if local mechanical whiz kid can make the head's eyes seem to blink from time to time, you've got the display of the year. Finally, banner the ghoulish exhibit with the intriguing copy line, for example, "Don't lose your head when you see he knows you're alone coming to this theatre." Which I just kind of, I just love all those kind of things, because you'd never, you know, in today's multiplexes, you would never get anything approaching that, would you?
No.
It must have been so much fun to go to films back in the day. I know whether or not anyone actually ever did any of that kind of stuff, I don't know. But
I think I saw a, for the One Direction film, a big cardboard stand-up thing where you could stick your head through a hole and make it look like you were with One Direction.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well,
which is kind of as good as it gets these days.
Did you do that?
I didn't, no.
No. Okay.
I'm too handsome to be in One Direction.
Too old.
Well, I'm not 16, I'll give you that, but...
Mm.
Well, I was just looking through old newspaper clippings that I have of the cinemas I were in my hometown when I was growing up, and He Knows You're Alone played on a double bill with Coma, the Michael Crichton movie, in June of 1981, and you could have left that and then gone into The Late Show of Friday the 13th, part one, which would have been a nice little triple bill.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yes. Yeah, well, that sounds good. I think I'm kind of run out of trivia now for Who Knows You're Alone, but what we do have coming up next is an interview with Kathleen O'Heaney, who's absolute sweetheart, and she's really, really nice. And she gave me loads of ideas how to heal my foot as well. She's very, very sweet. And she's got some very funny stories about making He Knows You're Alone, and also, of course, Savage Weekend, which is the film we've covered on the podcast way back when. So, yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to Kathleen. And here she is.
Seen Marvin around lately?
Seen him around? I can't get rid of the guy. You know, the closer it gets to my wedding, the bigger pain he gets to be.
Tell him to get lost.
I can't. I like him.
Maybe you should marry him instead of Phil.
And spend the rest of my life joking about dead bodies? No, thank you.
Oh, you know, there's this real cute guy I see jogging every morning.
Yeah?
He stares at me all the time.
So why don't you let him pick you up?
No, I couldn't do that.
Why not?
You think I should?
I spoke with Armand yesterday, and he said to pass on his regards to you. He said, you're a real sweetie.
Oh, well, he was too. I mean, my God, he and I haven't seen each other or spoken, I think, since the premiere of the movie.
Wow. How did you get involved with He Knows You're Alone?
Okay, so what happened was that He Knows You're Alone was just basically another audition. I mean, my agent just called me and said, you have an audition for a movie. And what I was saying is that I don't like horror movies myself. Okay. I'm not a fan. I don't find being frightened entertaining. And so the real reason I did the movie was not because I really loved it, but because I needed the points to get into the union. Because you have to do a certain amount of work before you can get into the union. And I could have done a really, really rather bad horror movie right before that called Savage Weekend, which is not very well done at all. Very, very no money at all. And I did another movie. So, and it was good people, though. It was very good people. I mean, Edgar Lansbury and Joe Beru produced it, and I liked Armand, you know, when I met him. And Don Scardino was a up and coming actor at the time, and I was just starting out. So I was thrilled when Armand offered me the part, and actually filming it was a tremendous amount of fun. Now, we didn't have any money, so we were, Armand was very lucky. Well, he actually, I guess he was very smart in that he cast such wonderful actors. I was really pleased to work with everybody because everybody was so wonderful. And we all were just starting out. But most of the takes that you see in that movie are first takes. Because there was no money.
Well, you said Armand said he said it was a it took about 15 days to shoot. So it was very right. it was almost like a guerrilla film, very quick and dirty and just very very, you know, so I imagine that must have been quite a lot of fun because you did those quite a lot of stunts, wasn't there, towards the end of the film when you're being chased by Tom Rolfing, the killer, around the morgue and also the driving. Did you do the driving yourself?
I don't remember that. No, I don't think I did. The scene where he grabs me through the door, you know, and I stab his arm, that was one take.
Wow, really? That was quite impressive, wasn't it?
But that's what I'm saying. Most of those scenes were the first take because, as I remember, I seem to think that Armand said, look, we've got so much film in the can, so if we can get this in 1 to 3 takes, it would be terrific, every scene. But one of the reasons I really, really love He Knows You're Alone is because I feel that I learned how to be a film actress. Rather than a stage actress, because there's such a difference. And the first day I met Tom Hanks, now it was Tom's first movie too, and I had the scene with Tom, you know, standing in line at the amusement park. If you remember that,
yes, I do. Yes,
right. And Tom had, I think, 3 little scenes in the movie, and I was standing on the set, and I'd already been shooting for about, you know, I don't know, you know, a week already. And I had just come off a Pirandello play right before I started He Knows You're Alone. And I don't know if you're familiar with the playwright Pirandello.
I'm afraid I'm not, but...
Well, he's a 19th century playwright and quite dramatic. And to do stage anyway, you know, you have to project to the 15th row. So, you know, it's just big. And so I just come off this Pirandello play, and I feel that when you watch He Knows You're Alone, I feel that until my scene with Tom, I'm too big. I'm too big for the camera. That's my own personal feeling. But once I had my scene with Tom, I improved as a film actress, I feel, because I was standing there on the set and I was watching Tom film his first scene. Now, Tom hadn't done anything. He was like all of us. He was, you know, he hadn't done anything. And so, you know, we didn't know who he was. He didn't know who we were. I mean, he wasn't a star. And, but I was standing there watching him. And I was thinking to myself, this guy isn't doing anything. And I was watching, and I believe there was a monitor there. And I was watching him on it. I was thinking, this guy isn't doing anything. And I'm about to have a scene with him. And I thought, you know what? I got to bring my energy level down. And so I feel that in that scene with Tom, I did. I was successful. I brought my energy level down. And emulated what he did, and I feel that it improved me as a film actor. So that's just my own personal opinion. Other people say, "Well, we can't tell the difference," and I say, "Well, I can."
So you would do? I mean, what were your? Do you remember any other tales of Tom Hanks? I mean, he wasn't on the movie long, was he? But you worked quite closely. You were kind of in the movie. You were friends with Elizabeth Kemp, and I think it was Patsy Pease, wasn't it? It's the three friends.
Elizabeth and Patsy, yeah, they were terrific. I mean, it was just easy. It was just wonderful. It was very simple to play friends because it was friendly between us. There were no cat fights. There was no jealousy. We all basically were thrilled to be working, and we basically were just really having a good time. And Armand was wonderful. I wish I could tell you something, you know, more interesting than this, but I'm just trying to remember.
Well, no, it's very interesting. It's an absolute thrill to talk to you, Caitlin. I mean, one thing you talked about the premiere and the last time you saw Armand. Did you was it a big? Because are you from New York yourself, from the New York area?
No, not at all. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I grew up in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin.
Right.
And I went to Whitefish Bay High School. I was brought up a Roman Catholic, an Irish Catholic, and I gave that up in the fourth grade.
Right, there's something else we've got in common, Caitlin. I'm a lapsed Catholic as well, so.
Oh my gosh! Yes, when Sister Morris got up and gave us a lecture one day about how everybody that was Jewish was going to burn in hell because they were Jewish. Mm. And I raised my hand and I said, I'm confused. Wasn't Jesus Jewish? And she said, no, don't think about that. Never mind about that. He said, never mind? She goes, never mind. I said, but wait a minute. My best friend is Jewish. She goes to the public school. She's really nice, and so are her parents. Are they going to burn in hell? And she said, oh, absolutely.
It does put you off, doesn't it?
Well, my mother, I said, I'm not going back to that school. There's no way that, you know, Ellery Peck is going to burn in hell. And my mother said, no, you have to go back. And I said, no, I don't. She goes, yes, you do. And I said, okay, well, if I have to go back, then I'm not going to a Catholic high school like my older sister did. I'm going to the public high school. She goes, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. I said, the first day of school, you can drop me at Dominican high school, but I'm going over to Whitefish Bay. I said, I'm done.
Yeah, well, that's very brave, and it's a good decision. So excellent. Can you remember where you saw the film? Did you see it at a premiere? Was it in Staten Island or New York?
I'm trying to remember where. I can't remember. We shot it on Staten Island. But I don't remember where we saw it. I don't remember. I'm so sorry.
No, that's fine. But the other thing, you went out to Los Angeles, didn't you, to film a trailer for it? Is that right?
I did?
I think so. I think Armand said you...
Oh, tell me, what did I do?
I think Armand said that the whole crew and yourself flew out to Los Angeles because MGM picked up the film to release it because it was an independent and they wanted a new trailer. So the trailer of you sat by a mirror combing your hair and then the killer jumps through the mirror and grabs you. Does that ring any bells?
Oh, gosh, you're jogging my memory. That's okay. Right.
Yeah.
I remember we were so excited when MGM picked it up.
Yeah.
Because it's really amazing. I mean, what a coup that a major studio like that picked it up.
Absolutely.
And that's right. I'm sitting by a... Where did we do all those pictures, too? We did a whole photo shoot, like the photo shoot of me in the dressing room.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, because this was so long ago. so much has happened to my brain since then.
Not a problem. at all. I can't remember 30 years ago, to be honest. So, but do you remember if you, because you've kind of been one of the esteemed, what they call final girls. Have you heard of that term before?
Have I heard about what?
Sorry, it's the term final girl. It's it's a term that it was coined after Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. So it's a horror movie heroine who lives to see a new day. So who kind of defeats the monster or the killer. It's a term that's used. In fact, actually, Jamie Lee Curtis, who was obviously most famously in Halloween, she's going to be in a TV series called Final Girls coming up quite soon. I think it's ABC Family.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, so it was just, but you're actually kind of one of the few, well, there's quite a few in the early 80s of the heroines in horror movies who survived. So do you remember if there was any talk of there ever being a sequel to the film?
No, there never was. If there was, I wasn't a part of the conversation. Mm. But this TV series that you're talking about, I should be on it.
You should be, absolutely. Yes, I mean, there's lots of, I mean, do you ever get asked to go to conventions or do any kind of signings or anything like that?
Well, actually, last October, right, because it was literally the weekend of Hurricane Sandy. I actually went to my very first, they're called Chiller Conventions.
Yeah.
I went to my very first one, believe it or not, and signed photos for He Knows You're Alone and Savage Weekend. Also, people were sneaking in Tales of the Gold Monkey and, of course, 3 o'clock High, the movie I did, where everybody loves the character I played, Miss Farmer. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I haven't seen that one, no.
You haven't seen that? Oh, that's because you're into horror. Yeah, 3 o'clock High is a comedy. And Steven Spielberg produced it,
okay,
along with Aaron Spelling. Right, and Spielberg didn't want his name on it because of Aaron Spelling at the time. But everybody knows that Spielberg produced it. But Spielberg was there, but that's a whole other story. You don't want to hear about that.
Can I ask a little bit about Savage Weekend? Because it sounds like you didn't enjoy that film, or you said it wasn't... was that your first film?
That was the very, very first film I did. And I remember that when I got it, I was just fresh out of Juilliard. And I happened to be walking down Broadway. And I ran into John Houseman with Margot Harvey and Liz Smith. And I don't know if those names mean anything to you.
John Houseman does. Yes. And there's a Liz Smith, right, but I think she's British. I might be a different one.
Well, Liz Smith was our voice and one of our speech teachers. And Margot was the administrator under John Houseman, so the drama division at Juilliard. And John is why I'm an actress, right after my algebra teacher, because he completely believed in me. When other people didn't, and I have so many stories about John, but I mean, he just completely believed in me 100%. And so anyway, right after I got Savage Weekend, literally, I mean, I think it was that day or something, I ran into them and I told John and Margot and Liz, and John was so concerned because I said, oh, I got this movie. And he was like, all right, darling. Now it's not a porno, is it? I said no. It is really low budget, and it's a thriller. And you know, I think I take my top off. I'm not sure. He goes, no, darling. Please. You're sure it's not porno. You're sure it's not porno. He says, no. It's not. I read the script. It's not. But it was so. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. It's just that it was fun doing it because it was my first movie, and we did it upstate. Originally, the title was Upstate Murders. That was the original title. And Marilyn Hamlin played. She played my friend. And oh God, I can see the actors. I can't remember their names. there just literally was, it was done for a dollar. I mean, there was no money whatsoever. And the script was not really very good. You know, basically, it's, you know, it wasn't, what can I say?
It was the first movie. So.
It was what?
It was your first movie. I think that's kind of, I think there's always, I think it's, not many people are lucky enough to be in a fantastic movie first off, but I think the film actually didn't get released until 1981, so actually a year after He Knows You're Alone.
Right.
To capitalize, am I right in thinking you're making a film, or you've been filming a film called Late Phases?
Right, I put that in my email to you. Yes, no, we finished it. It was it was terrific. It turns out that I was very, very blessed. The director and the producers are big fans of mine, and they love He Knows You're Alone.
Oh, okay.
And of course, 3 o'clock High and Tales of the Gold Monkey and all that. Adrian Garcia Bogliano is the director. And the title is, well, it was when we filmed it, Late Phases. And the producer is, I don't want to get this wrong. Brent Kunkel, I think is his name, and I can't remember the name of his partner. Wonderful.
I'm just having a look, actually, on IMDb to see what that his name is. I'm just losing. It's there we go. It's Larry Fessenden, Brent Kunkel, and Zach Zenham. Yes, and it's got lots of other people who were in horror movies in the 80s as well, isn't it? Lance Guest, Britannia Alda, so all those people as well. So was it a fun film to make?
Oh, it was terrific. It was just so much fun. In fact, I have a friend right now that's writing another horror movie with a part in it for me I'm going to give to Adrian and Brent to see whether or not they want to produce it again, and, you know, another one, because it was such a wonderful experience working with them and everybody in the cast. It was Luciana Alda, wonderful actress. She was a deer hunter. That was her first movie. I think one of her first movies was a deer hunter with, you know, Meryl Streep.
Yes.
Tina Louise. I don't know if you know the actress Tina Louise.
She was in was it Tim Burton movie, Mars Attacks, wasn't she? I think.
I had no idea whether she was in that. I mean, here in America, she's best remembered as Ginger on the TV series Gilligan's Island.
Right.
But you're not supposed to talk to her about that. She doesn't want to remember that.
All right, fair enough. So.
I've never mentioned Ginger to her.
Okay.
But it was Lance Guest, and it was Nick DiMicci, I think it was his name, was the lead. I'm not Lance Guest. Is it Lance?
Lance Guest.
Lance was so funny. We have a scene together, and he wasn't supposed to make me laugh, but it was like he was channeling John Cleese, and he knew he was doing it, and he kept apologizing to Adrian, saying, "I'm so sorry. I don't mean to be channeling John Cleese. It just is happening," and so. We had to do a number of takes because he kept making me giggle.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. What was the? Can you tell us a little bit about what the film's about without giving too much away?
I'm not allowed. I'm not kidding you. We all signed a statement saying that we couldn't say what the movie is.
Fair enough. Do you have any idea if it's got distribution? Is it going to be out released soon?
Well, Brent. The last day of filming, Brent was saying that they're going to be submitting it to Sundance. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
Film festival, yeah. And to all the other film festivals, and that it'll be released in 2014.
Excellent.
But trust me, I think you'll like it.
Excellent. No, I look forward to it. And just last question, Caitlin. Just do you? I mean, first of all, thanks ever so much for talking to me. I think the people on the show and the listeners to the podcast will be absolutely thrilled that we've spoken to yourself and Armand. They're going to be very, very happy. But are you surprised how the longevity of the fandom for He Knows You're Alone? Would you have thought this film would still have a following after all this time?
No. I'm absolutely thrilled, and I'm absolutely flummoxed. I can't believe it. I mean, it's become a cult classic. It truly has, which I'm so proud of. And I'm just so thrilled for Armand and for Edgar Lansbury and Joe Guru. I mean, it's a testament to their work. And also, gosh, I feel so bad. Oh, what was the name of the writer? The screenwriter?
Scott Parker?
Yes, Scott. Yeah. Yes, I'm so happy for him. I'm so proud of him. I'm so happy for him. I think one of the reasons it also has legs is because of the presence of Tom. And for a while there, it was annoying that they would say, He Knows You're Alone, starring Tom Hanks. So I thought, okay, come on, I know Tom is a huge, huge star now, but give us a break.
do you remember... Okay. Just one last thing. Do you remember the other Tom on the film? It was Tom Rolfing, wasn't he, who played the killer, who looked quite scary. Armand was saying he was a very sweet, nice guy. What are your memories of him?
Yeah, he was nothing like the killer, no. That was wonderful acting. No, Tom Rolfing was wonderful and sweet and nothing like the character whatsoever, no. Don Scardino, now... who played Marvin, right? Don was naturally very funny and very kind of quirky, and he went on to be the executive producer of the TV series 30 Rock. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes, well, I didn't know that. I know the show, but wow, that's impressive as well, isn't it?
I know, and so Don was very. Don was very much like Marvin, off screen as well. Goofy, funny guy. But no, Tom Rolfing was a very sweet guy, very sweet guy.
Excellent.
But how is Armand? He was
charming. He's been very supportive, and he sent over. Lots of photos from behind the scenes, which I have to send some over to you because I'm not sure if you've seen them. If you haven't seen them since the film came out, there's lots of photos of you and Elizabeth Kemp and Patsy Pease and Tom Hanks together on the set. So if you'd like to see them,
I would love to see them.
I will send them over to you. So, but thank you ever so much for talking today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I've been a big fan of the film for a long time. So it's been a real thrill for me to speak to you. So, and also to a fellow vegan as well. So it's been brilliant.
Oh, I know. But could I make a suggestion?
Of course.
Okay. The woman that. I have a friend who's a huge, horror movie aficionado. And she's the one that got me into the Chiller Convention because she's a PR person.
Yeah.
And so she got me into the Chiller Convention. Well, she called me this past summer, and she said that she stood outside the stage door where Tom Hanks was doing The Normal Heart, the Broadway show that he did last summer.
Yeah.
And... she was one of course, hundreds of people that were standing outside the stage door. And when she came out, everybody was screaming, but she held up a photo from He Knows You're Alone. And she said that he immediately focused on her because he was so happy to see He Knows You're Alone.
Right.
Because,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he immediately walked over to her, spoke to her, signed the autographed it for her, and he was thrilled that somebody remembered him and he knows you're alone. So, I don't know. You might want to contact his manager.
But to be honest, you were my number one that I wanted to speak to, you and Armand. So I'm absolutely delighted we've got you both on the show. So I think it's going to be a huge thrill and treat for everyone involved. And
you're very sweet. It's been a lot of fun speaking with you. And like I said, I was thrilled to hear that you're a fellow vegan. Okay. All right. Wonderful.
Yeah, have a lovely time with your cats in the sunshine, and thank you, Caitlin. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hey, what is it? What's the matter?
He's after me, Marvin. He's trying to kill me. He killed Nancy.
What are you talking about?
The man that I saw through the window, do you remember? He's after me. He's here. He's trying to kill me.
Amy, we've been through all this before. Nobody's after you. Nobody's trying to kill you. There's nobody... You mean this whole thing's been on the level?
Yes. What are we going to do?
Do? You're going to call the police, and I'm going to go check it out. I'll be right back.
Oh, no, Marvin, please be careful.
You don't have to tell me that. I'll be right back.
And that was the lovely Caitlin O'Heaney. So thank you, Caitlin, for speaking to us. And I keep on calling you Caitlin, and I do apologise for that, but I think it's Caitlin. So... I hope you enjoyed our kind of tribute to He Knows You're Alone. We'll tell you what we're going to be covering next on the next show at the end of the show. But before we do that, we've got some feedback. Well, actually, before we do that, even let's play the how to contact the show and let us know what you think.
Be sure to search for and like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at @THC_podcast. Our voicemail is 858-233-9281. And you can email us directly at the.hysteria.continues@gmail.com.
Okay, and please do get in touch with us. We've got a few bits of feedback. We've got a voicemail we'll come to in a minute. But Joseph, I believe you have a bit of written feedback even.
Yes, this is from Doug from slashermovieblu-ray.blogspot.co.uk. He says, "Hi everyone at Hysteria Continues. I've been a big fan of the show for some time now and have meant to write in to give you all a well-deserved pat on the back. Slasher movies are frighteningly underappreciated in this day and age, and you fly the flag proudly. I'm probably a little late, but I've just listened to the Friday 3 show. I had to wait a little while as I wanted to watch the Blu-ray from the new U.S. box set first to refresh my memory. A great film, and your insight was very appreciated. Excuse me. I have a not particularly well-written small blog that hopefully some of you listeners and yourselves might find useful. You see, I'm on a bit of a mission to try and create the biggest and best collection of slasher movies on Blu-ray from around the world. I try and post any news I stumble on about upcoming titles, but more importantly, I have an ongoing list of what films are available and where they're from. I found it particularly useful myself, as I seem to have a memory like a sieve and often forget anything obscure that may be out or coming soon. Excuse me. The collection is going well with around 150 different movies, but there's plenty more out there, and I'm always hopeful that more gems are given the HD respect they deserve. It's been a great year for slashers on Blu-ray, and there's some cracking titles coming soon, such as the Complete Chucky Collection, Prom Night, Chopping Mall Curtains, and Maniac Cop 2 and 3, to name a few. I'd like to particularly thank Justin, as Hysteria Lives has been an invaluable resource, as many of the more obscure titles I stumble on, I often don't even know if they are in fact slasher movies, and I use your site as a guide to what is and isn't. Plus, Teenage Wasteland is a fantastic read, so cheers for that. I was wondering if you might consider reviewing more modern slashers just to change it up a bit. Stuff like modern classics such as Switchblade Romance, a.k.a. High Tension, or remarkably entertaining or remarkably entertaining fluff like Killer Movie. All the best, Doug. He says, P.S. I'm rooting for The Night Before Easter. Really looking forward to seeing it. What are the chances of a Blu-ray? And then he says, P.P.S. Top three slasher movies you'd like to see on Blu-ray. For me right now, I'd love to see Valentine, Cheerleader Camp, and Slumber Party Massacre. And that was from Doug.
All right. Well, thank you, Doug, for the kind words. And also, can you read out his Blogspot address again?
That is Slasher Movie Blu-ray. That's blu/ray.blogspot.co.uk.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Doug. And also, we should talk a little bit about The Night Before Easter, because we're almost at the end, aren't we, of the fundraising?
Yeah, well, to answer his question, it's not really, I'm going to say it's not really feasible to put this on Blu-ray because of cost and because of, it will be in a high-definition film, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, any different on Blu-ray than it would be on DVD, but it is coming to DVD, so there you have it.
Excellent. And any news about how long, if this show's going out today, so on the day we record it, so how long have people got to pledge?
5 days. You can go to Indiegogo.com and just search for The Night Before Easter. And if you can pledge anything, even if it's just a dollar, that would help. We've got four people cast out of 15 or 16 roles. We've got a lot of music for the film already written. A lot of it will be rewritten to, you know, fit specific scenes. And yeah, it's going really well. I mean, we could always use a little more advertising, and if you can, you know, spare a few nickels, that's always great. So we're really looking forward to shooting. We start shooting in November, and trust us, this is really going to be a fun movie. We're really going to take our time with it and put out something, you know, worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm really looking forward to seeing it, and you're going to keep us updated, aren't you, on the progress?
Yes.
So excellent. And also, just actually talking about our friends making slasher movies, Jake Helgren, who was on the show, who did Bloody Homecoming, has just come out on DVD and has been getting, to be honest, has been getting very, very good reviews most places. I had a horrible review on one place.
Where did it get a bad review?
Don't slander anyone.
Oh. Never mind.
Why would we be slandering
anyone? Well, I mean, you can't. I don't care. I mean, I'm just saying, I don't know if you want to slander anyone or not.
Okay. Well, all I'm saying, it was a very negative review, wasn't it, on a certain website. But he got ripped a new asshole by lots of people. So, but
ass, not ours.
Yeah, he's totally turned an American. Totally. Do you want some cilantro with that?
I'll just have some oregano with that, yes. Yeah. But everywhere else has been giving it really good reviews. So, sorry, Nathan.
That was a terrible review. The guy who reviewed Bloody Homecoming didn't really say why it was a bad film. He basically just kind of went into the movie with no, you know, subtext as why it's bad. He just said it's bad, and he just was really mean, really mean spirited, and it's not very cool.
Yeah, and also he'd never heard of Hysteria Lives. Well, there you go. So I think that tells you everything you need to know. So, yes. But as for movies on Blu-ray, like slasher movies on Blu-ray, I'm trying to think, actually, what would I really like to see? I'll tell you what I'd love to see that hasn't come out is Halloween, 1978.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
No, I'm joking. But that's been out in the States, isn't it, the new Halloween disc? But it's not out in the UK until
November.
It's October, November?
21st of October, I think Amazon said.
Okay, right. Okay. But there's so many films out there. I mean, to be honest, my wish list would be Friday the 13th, Part 2 and 3, uncut on Blu-ray. I'm boycotting the box set.
Yeah.
I think it's such a...
Me too.
Such a pale cash-in. I can't see there's any point buying it, really, apart from to get a few of the later films on Blu-ray. But that doesn't really
bother me. And just in case anyone's wondering... a lot of people are, you know, they want to see this uncut footage on Blu-ray and, you know, maybe eventually it will show up. But if you go to YouTube and search for Friday the 13th uncut, you will see a lot of the uncut footage. So I wouldn't even spend your money on this release. It's basically just a rehash. It's basically ported from the DVD just to Blu-ray. There's not much changes at all.
Well, they haven't done any new they haven't spent any money doing anything new, have they?
No.
So, which is a shame. But
well, new packaging.
Well, new packaging. Yes, fair enough. But it's not the ultimate. But they always call these things like the ultimate box set, don't they? But it never really is, is it?
Eric, you like new packages, don't you?
Yes, I like to have a wide variety of packages.
Do you get them? Do you get them to your door? Do you sort of receive?
Sometimes I have to go out and pick them up.
Okay, so because I heard you enjoy receiving swollen goods around the rear.
Well, you've heard wrong.
Oh, have I? Okay, right. Thank you for that. And we've got a voicemail. Should we go into the voicemail next? And I believe
this is for Nathan, by the way. This voicemail is specifically directed at Nathan.
I can feel an Inga moment coming on.
Hey, gentlemen. It's Brett calling you again. Also, still from the gym, which is now less than 30 days away from its closure date. And a very, very sad day it will be for us all. I had a few things to say. About Sleepaway Camp, I stand by what I said. And so does my brother, who watched Sleepaway Camp 2 with me, and we couldn't believe how awful it was. And we started 3, thinking, oh my gosh, it's only 80 minutes, we can make it. And then we just turned it off and said, these are horrendous, and I'll never watch them again. But I will watch 1 for the rest of my life. I just wanted to also say I really liked your Friday 13th 3 show. I would love to see that in real 3D. And not this shit-ass Blu-ray crap that they put out. I mean, I didn't watch that. I heard it looked horrendous. I want to see an original 82 film print, maybe a little cleaned up, maybe with the sound beefed up, but I want proper flying things coming out my face, big, sharp, pointy things just flying out at me. That's what I love, you know? And who knows, maybe one day I will, but I've heard only a few prints exist, and they play in, in Texas sometimes, or there's one in Canada. Maybe one day I'll take a road trip up there to see it. Another thing, I have to say something. It's going to be rather controversial, but maybe even bullying, but how can I say this respectfully? I love you, Nathan, very much. You're good. But sometimes, I don't know, your taste. Like, I think I remember one where you said Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was good or something.
Oh, yes.
It was, brilliant. It was not. I think you might be the only person in the world that thinks that. It was really quite horrendous. It was almost worse than Sleepaway Camp 2. That's right. I said it. And, ooh, I also wanted to compliment Meep. I thought he was a good guest star. I thought he had a rather sexy voice, too. Maybe you could pass that message along to him. Forward those pictures I sent in the past. That's about it. I'm looking forward to He Knows You're Alone, Tom Hanks and Dana Barron. One I watched in college, I thought it was rather forgettable, but I'm sure your discussion of it will be pretty good. Okay, I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Thanks. Well, over to Nathan.
Well, I stand by what I say. Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is brilliant. Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3 are brilliant. And my seventh cousin agrees with me.
Well, I think this one could run and run, couldn't it? But always nice to hear from Brett. And also very sad that your gym is shutting down. But thank you for keeping us up to date.
I think he's the only one who sends voicemail these days.
Yeah, we need some more voicemails. We need to hear what you say. But
you know, that's why I'm willing to withstand the bullying and the meanness that comes my way, because he at least does send in voicemails.
Yes, exactly. But also breaking
news. I have
news.
Withstood the slings and arrows of an imperfect world without so much as a whimper or complaint.
That is true. Is that Simpsons again?
Actually, it's from Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Okay, yeah.
It sounded like a perfect opportunity for you to play the violins again.
Breaking news. I've just had a message from Elizabeth Kemp, who plays Nancy, and He Knows You're Alone.
Wow, it's like we're in the CNN newsroom.
It is. It's breaking news. And she sent me I sent her 10 questions, and she's written back very long answers, actually. So I'm not going to read all of it out, but I will read out just one of the answers if you want to hear them, and I'll post rest to the site. I'm thinking what I might do for He Knows You're Alone, because I've got so much material for it now, that I might do one of those retrospectives like I did for Happy Birthday to Me and The Burning on Hysteria Lives, because I've got so much now. So
did you
Did you just now get that, Justin?
I just got it. Just got it now. Just pinged through.
Because that's weird. Because it said this is from Elizabeth Kemp. Please forward to Justin.
Oh, shut up! Mm-hmm. Right. I'm just going to say. I'll just read out this one, but. It says work, you know, if there's anything behind the scenes. She said, the only fun tales I have behind the scenes were how I discovered craft services could change one's weight and complexion and what in the world I could do in order to not take a shower naked. We tried it with basketball shorts, of all things, and they kept getting in the shot. Finally, I said, to hell with it. There's no other way to take a shower but without clothes on. It was a tiny shower, and still Armand and the crew helped me feel very comfortable. I'm sure we had a few laughs over it. I did worry about my parents' reaction, of course. I could not bear the aesthetics, shall we say, once I saw it, no pun intended. Also, in the scene with the headphones, when I'm decapitated, I'm quite sure it was a real knife. I remember saying to the actor playing the killer, please tell me you know what you're doing. Apparently he did. I felt a tremendous sense of trust in him. Frankly, in retrospect, the shower scene had me most concerned. She says, I asked her if she'd seen it recently. She says, she said, I got a call a few years from Quentin Tarantino. Apparently used to work in a video store. He watched every sort of movie possible. He remembered me from this and another thriller by the same director and producer called The Killing Hour. So yeah, there's another fan of the movie. But yeah, there's lots here. So, I will post that at some point. So I'll get back to Elizabeth after the show. So, yes, breaking news. So, over to you, Eric.
Okay, I've got a long one.
We haven't had hold on, let me just...
Matron, no, please, hold your hand.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, I've got one here from Andy Fitzpatrick, a.k.a. Dr. X. He says, hi all, just wanted to drop you a line to say I love the show. I've been a regular visitor to Hysteria Lives for many years, but for some reason I didn't become aware of the accompanying podcast until a few months ago. What a fool I've been, but what treats I've found. You fellas do a terrific job covering an unloved subject, matter and always with such, well, panache. Apart from the one time Justin got drunk, but we'll gloss over that. For me, it's... Yeah, that's his words, not mine, Justin. For me, it's always a joy to hear you exploring these great forgotten classics. Not just the headliners, although they're fun too. It's pure gravy for a cult horror fan like myself, who likes to poke around in dark corners, hoping to unearth hitherto unseen gems. I ask you, where else can you enjoy full and lengthy reviews of films like Criminally Insane and Nailgun Massacre? Personally, I lean towards 70s and 80s films, being of the same generation as the show members, but fans of contemporary horror are well served too, and you do a great service to people seeking newer films that aren't turgid or obnoxious. Having said all that, the secret behind the show's appeal lies in its personalities and their variety. Leading the charge is Justin, the always informative but slightly naughty and occasionally sozzled professor of slash. You've got a reputation, Justin.
I have. Followed by Eric. Excuse me.
Yeah, followed by Eric, the insightful, affable, and even naughtier 80s-loving bear. Nathan, the shepherd of the lost and unloved, and of course Joseph, the soft-centered tough guy with a found footage addiction. God help you, sir. It's a great recipe that works not only because it delivers, but because you regularly go against type. When Nathan says he hates an early 80s slasher film, to give an example, the audience takes note. God, that film must be beyond human endurance, I find myself thinking, and immediately seek out said title. And Joseph, no, you're not the only one who thinks Aliens is vastly overrated. In 30 years' time...
I didn't say Aliens is vastly overrated. I just said it's a... I said I prefer the first one. I don't think it's great. I mean, I think it's a good movie, but I never said it's vastly overrated. But anyway,
he's agreeing with you.
I prefer the first one. Yeah. In 30 years' time, when they remake this podcast, we all know it'll be dreadful. Not necessarily because of a lack of informative hosts. Heaven knows the world's full of experts. But because the stand-ins for Justin, Eric, Nathan, and Joseph will be obnoxious, loudmouthed twats with all the charm and charisma of sour milk. Unlike the originals, who more than anyone give slasher fans a good name. All the best, you crazy diamonds. Love from Andy Fitzpatrick, a.k.a. Dr. X.
Wow.
So I don't know. Thank you very much, Andy, for that.
Yeah, thank you, Andy.
Yeah.
He just joined the Body Count Continues forums about 2 weeks ago, and he's a pretty cool guy. Yeah, I like him so far.
Excellent. Well, nice. No, that's the kind of feedback. Well, not because you were so nice about us, but it's you know,
he did refer to you as being a bit of a drunken lout. on two occasions in that email.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's I play acting because I never touch anything stiffer than you know, Camomile tea, as you know, Eric. Although, yes. God, I was drinking something called rhubarb tea last night, which is some kind of liquor.
Oh, it's
never mess with another man's rhubarb.
Yeah, it's kind of. It's called rhubarb tea, but it's this. It's kind of some kind of. It's some kind of spirit, but it's quite nice. But I was a bit hungover this morning, so I'm playing to type.
Well, just thank your lucky stars you didn't fall down another hill.
Well, exactly. I nearly came a cropper early, actually, and fell over the tripped over the extension cable on the computer, so I nearly broke the other ankle.
Oh, dear.
So, I know.
See, the picture he posted on Facebook had a big bruise on it, so I thought Eric would kind of make fun of him because it's all dark and gruesome like a goth.
You see, I couldn't see a bruise on your
goth
ankle.
You couldn't see a bruise?
No, it just looked like a normal ankle.
It's a giant blue and purple line. You didn't see it?
When I broke my ankle, the whole thing was completely black.
Yes, well, I haven't broken my ankle.
And swollen.
Yeah, well, mine's swelled up quite big.
Yeah, I'm sure
and the
has.
Ankle.
So, were you watching Supernatural at the time?
Sorry?
I said, were you watching Supernatural at the time?
No, I was not. So, have we got any more feedback? Or is that a lot?
Mm-hmm. That's the lot.
That's all. Now, I do have to say, we do have a roast from BTK, but we're going to save it for the next episode because it's kind of long, and this episode's already running close to 3 hours. So,
I think it's going to be over 3 hours when I put the slip the interviews in. So I think on that bombshell, well, the next bombshell actually will be what film we're covering next time, and I think that's over to you, Joseph, isn't it?
Yes, our next film will be Candyman from 1992.
Mm. I hear you're looking for Candyman, bitch.
Well, I can see this is going to be a fun show. Bitch. So have you got Russell Todd lined up for an interview?
Russell Todd?
Not Russell Todd, sorry. What's Todd?
Virginia Madsen.
Tony Todd.
Tony Todd.
Tony Todd.
Tony Todd. No, I have met Tony Todd, but no interview.
No, okay. Well, we'll be covering Candyman
Clive Barker
next time. Yeah, Clive Barker.
No, I would like to interview Virginia Madsen.
I bet you would.
God, I would. Oh.
Don't forget to ask her about Electric Dreams.
What a woman.
Best film she was in.
Well, I think on that bombshell, literally the Candyman bombshell, we were doing that. And we've got something quite special planned, well, relatively special for Halloween, haven't we? But we're going to see if we can pull that off.
Yeah.
So, should we say a fond adieu?
Fondue.
Oh, I like fondue. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
I'm hungry.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll catch you on the flip side, won't we, Eric?
Yo. Word.
So say goodbye to the good folks at home.
Goodbye to the good folks at home.
Bye.
See you next time on The Hysteria Continues.
God, I got very Inga during that quiz.
You got very Inga.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I wasn't over Inga'd.
No. Well, I think it's what everyone
expects
forward to, doesn't it? I know. You're playing up to your public.
That's it.
Lord Hereford's knob.
They do. Because can you imagine? Can you imagine like Susie having to go for a poo? No, you can't, because it doesn't happen, because she's a celebrity, so they have a special operation.
Or they have someone to poo for them.
Yeah, that's it. Hello? Nobody there? I'm going to get another Coke, I think. I need to put some clothes on first, though.
And they mentioned three cocks.
Oh,
that's Joseph's vibrator.